in overtime, which we call deadline. And deadline is today. So quite clearly we have to get to that position. So what I would like to say at the outset is that we will have to, as we've got that afterwards, we will look at, start off with the SASL, and then I'm now looking at members of committee. We're expecting Honourable Akongi, he's something about the passport, he's running late, and we're expecting Honourable Mabasa from Small Business, because as you know, the small business budget is still contained within trade and industry. So when we get there, and I'd like members to be very aware of this, what we are going to do is switch immediately to the conclusions, if you follow, so we can pass this in the interim. So unless there is a member here who wants to raise a serious impairment in the conclusions they have seen, indicating it won't be a smooth process there, and the recommendations, and the intro, they should raise it now before we adopt the agenda so we can change the agenda, amend it if necessary. So I like anyone who would have a problem with that process that we're forced to undertake to raise their hand. Right, it would appear as if we're all right. And I see Professor Turok coming in, and Professor Turok, we're always happy to see you because you are a reservoir of information and advice. Thank you. On that note, on opening and welcome, I'd like to give the official apologies.
Chairperson, receive apologies from Advocate Albert, Mr. McPherson, Mr. Mang, Mr. Chiwambu, and Ms. Mantash, all related to party political business.
Just mention them again.
Mr. Simang from the IFP, Mr. Albers from the Freedom Front, Mr. Kfirsten from the Democratic Alliance, Ms. Mantash from the ANC, and Mr. Floyd Chiwambu from the EFF.
Yeah, the Honourable Floyd Chiwambu, I understand, has a parliamentary apology, and that is, he represents Parliament and Pan-African Parliament. So that's a very different kind of apology, you follow. It's not a party apology, it's a parliamentary issue. When it comes to the others, I want this for the third time on record, and I'd like to sign this letter to the Honourable Elvis, indicating he represents all minority parties other than the IFP and the UDM. And therefore, I want to find out if they are aware we haven't seen them for 2 months. I would like that letter sent, because I don't want to see such a broad apology again. And I'd like to sign it a day before 12. Right. Now we come to the adoption of the agenda on the basis of prioritizing the BRRR. I hope that's quite clear. We have also had an engagement, a pre-meeting committee engagement with SASL, who wants to discuss certain sensitive issues which require the leader in this part, in this committee of the opposition to be here, and the decision we've taken on that may at the time. Thank you. So on that note, please can we have someone to propose the adoption of the agenda? Thank you, Honourable Lienge.
Thank you, Chair. I move for the adoption of the agenda as presented, as amended.
Thank you. Honourable Yenge and Honourable Kuoho. Thank you. To the SASL, you will recall that we invited them to come back. SASL is, after all, a strategic industry in our country, and has become quite a significant player on the international scene. And also see here, and I've just seen him now, I'm so sorry, and that is from DTI, represented it's Mr. Munger, I think, and I'm just looking here for your name, I don't see it. It says Damana, and I don't think you are Mr. Damana, are you? No. This is the third time I've corrected that. This is Mr. Samanga, who has been with us several times now. Perhaps you should come a little forward so we can recognize you. Now, because we are on Cecil, we asked you to come back because we weren't satisfied that you had been entirely frank with us about the issues. However, you have responded in the letter, and I would now like you to address the issues briefly.
Honourable Chair, thank you, members of the committee. Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. Once again, thank you for...
Please give your name for the record on hand side.
I apologize, Madam Chair. My name is Johan Dreyser. I will introduce the team in a little bit. Firstly, just thank you for this invitation to share our thoughts on beneficiation. I think the committee has directed a number of questions at us, and what we intend doing is to in fact address those questions in our presentation at an elevated level. We've also provided a written submission to those questions to the Chair, and also having regard to what the Chair has just said in terms of the time constraints, we will try and, let's say, go a slightly faster to the first part of our presentation. I think it's straight into the Parliament Business Briefing part, which I will speak to. But before I do that, I would like to introduce the team. To my right is Norbert Behrens. Norbert is the head of strategic projects in, or heading of strategic projects in the CEO's office. Right behind me is Mr. Nell Stander. She is responsible for public and regulatory affairs. She's in fact my senior, so she's my boss. I'm a private visible who looks after strategy and development at Bain Chemicals, and you might have been here with me before as well. Then we also have Heido Asphalt, who is a parliamentary liaison. I think if the Chair allows, I'll go second to the agenda. We would like to take the committee through really three themes, which is number one, our understanding of beneficiation. The second part is the Parliament Business Briefing, which really relates to some of the questions or the questions that has been directed to Cecil, and then we wanted to offer some conclusions. As I've mentioned earlier, what we'd like to do is actually, instead of spending too much time on the first part, actually just briefly go through some of that, and then go straight into the Parliament Business Briefing, just because of the time constraints that I know that this committee has. So if the Chair allows me, I'm getting right into it, and talking about our understanding of beneficiation. I think if you look at the policy, the sphere out there, there are a number of policies that speak to beneficiation. Specifically, we believe that the mineral beneficiation strategy and head of the NDP are the ones we like to highlight, in that from the mineral beneficiation strategy, it's really, at the end of the day, identify a number of minerals that can be of advantage to us. And this is what we normally refer to as our comparative advantage. What the mineral beneficiation strategy also does is that it also sets up a number of challenges that we need to overcome in order to ensure that we in fact beneficiate successfully. Some of those are challenges that we are well aware of, which are skills, infrastructure. Similarly, the National Development Plan does the same, and we are clearly in support of that. I think what is very important is that common to all of this policy instruments is this value adding or adding value to raw materials that we see. Taking that and moving on to the IFACs, I think it's just very important, and I'm going to allow members to in fact read that for themselves so that I don't spend much time on that. But I think very importantly is just we identified five key interventions and key drivers where we have indicated our contribution and future plans specifically on these. The only two I'd like to highlight at this stage is number one and number three, which speaks to labor absorbing manufacturing I've earlier indicated in earlier hearings that SASL employs just over 29,000 people directly in South Africa, and we will continue doing so in terms of our strategy, in terms of to ensure our facilities remain sustainable until the year 2050. In terms of shale gas, like as we set out within the IMF6, we are as excited about the potential, and I think SASL would like to see to what extent we can use our international experience and we gain technically to be able to contribute and share the benefits with South Africa as well. The last one talking about beneficiation of mineral resources, I'm not going to get too much detail because this is in fact the reason why we are here. The next slide speaks to our technology. I've spoken to this the last time, so I'm not going to spend any time on this specifically. And then going straight into some of the challenges that we see in order to ensure that we take this comparative advantage that we have and be able to couple that with our competitive advantage. If we look at the World Economic Forum competitiveness scores, if we look specifically at innovation, infrastructure, and labor market efficiency, if you look at those particular scores, we don't look as bad, but if you drill down specifically on each of these, you will look at, and if I use innovation, there's a particular criteria that says what is the availability of your scientists and your engineers. And if you look at where we score out of 148 countries, we score at, I just want to make sure that I got the number right, at 108 out of 148 countries. Similarly, if you look at labor market efficiencies, and you look at relationships between employees and employer, we score 148 out of 148. And I think this is where we say we need to, as a country, work together in order to ensure we actually address some of these challenges. From a national perspective, on the innovation side, on the skills and socioeconomic development, we are trying to do this specifically, and this is one of the questions that were in fact directed to us at the last hearing, where it was requested from us, what is our contribution to socioeconomic development? Looking at the slide, only three areas that I could highlight. We contribute about 1.14, which is the last financial year. We contributed 1.4 billion rand to socioeconomic development. 901 million of that was spent on our employees. And we have a 47 million rand bursary scheme, which is one of the largest in South Africa, focusing specifically on science, technology, and engineering disciplines. And we currently have about 577 undergraduate and postgraduate bursaries. I think SASL is committed to ensuring that at least on one of these, we want to continuously invest into our people in South Africa. And with that, I'm going to allow Norbert to take us directly into the part of the business view.
Thank you, Johan. As Johan mentioned, I'm Norbert Behrens. I'm head of strategic projects in SASL. Madam Chair and honourable members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to address you on further questions on the polymer business. And at the outset, I'd like to say what I'm presenting today is aspects about this market which we believe are fundamental to understanding the polymer business, and in particular, pricing in South Africa. So the topics that I will be addressing cut across the questions that have been put to us, and will address the background in terms of how the mechanism of pricing of polymers works in South Africa. At the same time, I think the committee members are aware that the polymer pricing, particularly the polypropylene pricing, is a matter of appeal, and so we are not in a position to share all the pricing specific information with you. At the outset, a diagram you've seen before, but two points I'd like to highlight on this diagram is, first of all, as you will have noticed from our previous presentation, that we present and produce a number of products that cut across a range from liquid fuels and chemicals and intermediates. And the value add from starting from coal to selling products which are either at liquid fuel value or chemical value is, of course, a significant beneficiation step. And to continue doing this itself requires a lot of investment and commitment which we as a company have done, and as part of our 2050 project are setting ourselves up to run Secunda Complex until 2050. That requires quite a lot of renewal capital investment in itself, but it all goes to the topic of beneficiation of all these chemicals. The second point goes specifically also to your questions, and that is, in a complex like this, where in essence in one or two feedstocks you produce, in our case, literally close to 100 or more products, it isn't really possible to define the profitability of one specific project or product. So in some cases, like in polypropylene, where you can actually use propylene for more than one purpose, here you can then measure its profitability against its alternative value. But for the bigger part of the products, you are in a position where that is not the case. And if I may, I'd like to just make it akin to, or explain it again to, how you would explain if you slaughter a cattle. How much profit do you make on the fillet or on the liver or the tongue of the cattle or the hooves? You know what's paid for the cattle and you know what you're going to get for all of the products that you sell from cattle. But to say which one of those is actually more profitable than the other is actually not possible. And that's in principle how globally also refineries run, in that you take a barrel of oil and you make a number of products, but you cannot really say whether you're making more money in petrol or diesel. So refineries look at the global margin, the so-called refinery margin, and our complex in Secunda and natural gas is also no different. Some specific characteristics on the polymer market. You will have heard some of these points made by other presenters to this committee, other beneficiation. But in the context of your prices, I maybe just want to allude on some of them specifically. First of all, polymers are used in a whole range of products. So if one looks at pricing, its price and competitiveness, and the effect thereof on the markets, it is actually quite diverse. And the dynamics of every particular sector in that it's going is driving that particular sector's demand, of course. So if you're looking at the growth of polymers in packaging, it will depend on what the growth market is, for instance, of a bottle of water. If I can use this bottle as an example, this bottle is made of PET, the clear part. That's an imported polymer. Into South Africa, it's not made in South Africa. The cap is made of polypropylene. That's the product that we make. If one looks at the price of this bottle by the time it sells at the retail, the contribution of polypropylene in this bottle is less than a cent. So the extent to which the price of polypropylene will drive the final demand of this product and hence the demand for polypropylene in this sector is actually hardly noticeable. Now clearly if you're buying a garden chair at the Hyperama, which is 100%, a mere 100% polypropylene, the numbers are different. But our colleagues have been into the Hyperama, measured the weight of the chair and how much polypropylene is in there, and compared it to the price, and our component of that is less than 20%. So even a product that sells at near 100% content of polypropylene actually only has a comparatively small contribution at the end. Now we're not saying that polymer prices are hence immaterial in this whole aspect, but it's clear to understand what its proportion is in the whole value chain, and what the impact will have is on the further downstream by, for instance, dropping the prices, if one could, by another 5% or so. That the demand, in our view, is highly inelastic, and so that it will actually lead to a very small, if any, increase in production. So in polypropylene conversion. What we do understand at the same time, though, is that the South African converters are in many applications actually competing against imported products. And there the numbers are different. So the price at which they buy polypropylene puts them in a position where they now can sell more competitively against importers or not. So those are two different aspects, and we recognize that, and I'll come back to that later. Another aspect is looking at polymer growth, and Dr. Rothers has picked this up. He's talking about growth rates in South Africa for polymer. And we believe that the situation is a bit more complex than he portrays. One aspect about polymers which we need to also realize is that polymers, although they're products that are really, call it, post-Second World War, are still improving in essence every decade by a significant amount. So I mentioned one example here. If one looks at the polyethylene film that's typically used in wrapping pallets, so if you drive typically on a highway, that's where you see it, trucks with big pallets of fertilizer bags on, and then they what we call shrink wrap with polymer around that. Now for that particular application, for instance, since 1980, the amount of polymer that you use to get the same performance to hold that pallet table has dropped by 50%. Now that means if your polymer market is still growing in that application, it first has to make up another 50%, admittedly over the last 20 years, and before it shows any growth. And that sector is growing. Now the same, to a larger or lesser extent, applies for all the sectors that we're in. One will notice if you travel abroad, the PET bottles are thinner. And there's more and more emphasis, as we all know from an environmental point of view, to downgauge and get the polymer that's actually used less. So if one is looking at growth curves of polymer markets, we sell and measure it in tons. We don't sell it and measure it in bottles or meters or film. So that's another aspect that makes it quite more enriching or the complicated to understand how the market is actually performing. The last point I'd just like to raise is around the transport cost of polymers. The transport cost. So polymers, and that's the reason, and as a matter of explanation, we sell pellets. So the polymer is in the form of a little pellet, which is put into a 25 kilogram bag, that's like a fertilizer bag, and then stacked on a pallet and sold. That amount of polymer, so if we take a ton of polymer and would want to move it to Hong Kong, for instance, it would only cost $15 from Durban to Hong Kong. It costs about $40 to $50 to get it to Durban. But the point is for a product which sells somewhere between $1,500 and $2,000 a ton, the cost to move it has become actually very small. And I'll come back to this later in the context of how the world has changed, and we believe it actually influences the beneficiation strategy that South Africa needs to follow. So moving on to the next slide. Now I'll come to some of the more specific aspects about how polymer pricing has evolved in South Africa. Now prior to 1996, prices in our polymers, and I think like any other products, were what we would put under the regulated regime. So the government from time to time would adjust the price, and that would determine on what the international price is and what the profitability of making polymers was in South Africa. But as you're aware, in 1996 we came a signatory to the WTO, it was a year ago around, and all the trade barriers were aligned and harmonized with the WTO. For polymers specifically, the FOB tariff for imported polymers dropped to 10%. I'm going to my own memory. I worked in polymers at the time. On recollection, the effective tariff that the previous dispensation gave polymer sales was about 30 to 40%. So the price came down quite sharply. More importantly, but also the WTO alignment meant, is that polymers can be freely imported into South Africa. And prior to that, you had to get an input permit. So only certain people could import, and the government determined who was allowed to import polymers. The effect of this was that at least in part of the polymer industry, it had to go through a restructuring. There was a joint venture between the Prime Sasol and ASI because some of the assets just were completely uncompetitive. And we had to move it to bring in this instance, fuel value ethylene and close down other coal-based technology because looking forward, we knew that we would just not be profitable. But this effectively, in practice, connected the South African polymer price directly with the international price. And because South Africa is mostly easterly facing, that's meaning Durban towards the Indian Ocean, we were connected with the lowest regional price in the world, which is the Hong Kong polymer price. And I'll come back to that later. But the outcome of this move meant that South Africa has, in a way, a real-time polymer price internationally from the most competitive region ongoing. I recall at the time that many industries had to restructure when we signed up to the WTO, and that is part of the competitiveness process that the country went through, and some sectors did better than others in going through that process. The polymer industry wouldn't have been able to make without significant investment. propylene, which is the feedstock for polypropylene, is also directly related to the fuel value. So you can make petrol and diesel from propylene. And this is central to our decisions that we need to take, is that we can either put the propylene and make petrol or diesel, or we can make polypropylene. And that's how we measure the profitability of our investment. So we've been asked, how is it possible that the partner's business actually makes a loss, and from one year to the other, and the Synfuels business actually makes a profit? The reason for that is that the Synfuels business supplies, makes the fuel business, so it makes petrol and diesel. It also makes the chemical feedstocks for polymers, like propylene. Now, propylene can go either in petrol or diesel. When the oil price moves up, the petrol price typically moves up, so the value of propylene moves up. The decision point for us is, are you still going to make the same amount of money, more money, when you convert that propylene into polypropylene, or should you be putting it into fuels? Now, that's a question also of national...
for the committee just on that point. The fuel comes from what we have in our country, coal.
Yes.
That's right. We're not importing this fuel.
Correct.
Therefore, the change in the price is simply for you to actually move the Sasol price of what you've made and converted from coal into fuel into the imported fuel price. What's the need for that? What informs that decision? Because it's actually made up.
Yes. So
the coal hasn't changed. The process costs haven't changed. See, that's the question, the number. So what changes the price other than the fact that Sasol's policy is to ensure that the price itself, its fuel at the pumps, is the same as what is imported, as well as what itself downstream to anyone else. That's the issue. Because there's no need for it to be increased. Your costs remain the same.
Madam Chair, the value of it does change in that context. So the value, whether you put the propylene into fuel or put it into petrol, does change with the oil price. So through the petrol price, the value of propylene, which then rises or falls with the movement of the petrol and diesel price. So our decisions, and I'm talking for the start of an investment basis, is do we either produce more fuel, which is also in the interest of the country from a fuel balance point of view, but if we don't produce that fuel, it has to be imported, or do we make an investment and build a chemicals plant like a polypropylene plant and produce the chemical? The aspect to how the prices actually move, or the profitability, relates to if the fuel prices rise, typically polymer businesses come under pressure because the polymer price doesn't necessarily move to the same extent as the fuel price. And so you would get a business like the polypropylene business at times of high prices actually starting to make a loss. So the point that is raised is correct. Our polymer business has made for subsequent years a loss based on the value of the material that it's using. Coming back to the joining of the WTO.
Has the polypropylene business made an accounting loss or an economic loss?
Both. Yeah. In some years, so in the specific year that was asked, 2013, it's both. And in some in other years, it's been economic, but accounting has been positive. So.
Because this is the nub of the issue right here, actually. We do want other information, but this is actually why we asked you to return. And you can hear. And what I appreciate is the fact that you've given us some background on the polymers, which is more than we had before. We do appreciate that. But the issue becomes, and I want us to really unpack it now. Honourable Hill Lewis has separated it very efficiently into accounting and economic. You yourself referred to the issue of value. And I would imagine you were talking about the economic issue, but perhaps you can explain that. We've got this clear, I believe, in my mind, although I may need a visit to Cecil, that Carl comes in to you it then converts it. Coal is a polymer. It arises at which stage? At which stage do we get the polymer? Do we get the conversion? It becomes fuel. Fuel. You don't have a bundle of coal and it becomes polymer. It all becomes fuel. Is that correct or not? Now let's get that clear.
Yes.
And let's see where this price is changing.
Madam Chair, thank you for that question because it is indeed important. We brought back the diagram that I had earlier, and that could maybe assist a bit in answering the question. So I'll stay with the coal, although we use gas as a complementary feedstock as well, but I'll stay with coal. So we mine coal, and so it comes out of the mouth of the mine, quite literally in rocks as we all would identify coal. We take that coal, and then we, in simple terms, burn it. And we call it gasified, and that's burning coal under very specific conditions. And break down the coal literally to the molecular level, because we gasify it. So now we've got a stream, which is really coal in a gasified form. In the process of burning it, we've put in tea, water. So that's nothing different to what you have in your kettle when you turn on the kettle. You just do it under very specific conditions. That gas that comes out of that gasifier, as we call it, we actually convert that in the box where the arrow is right now. So that's what we call our SAS reactor. And that is the heart of Sasol. That's what we do that nobody else has to the extent that we actually are effective and the products that we produce from that coal. So out of that comes a whole range of products. It's a spectrum from a very light fuel gas, typically the same as natural gas, methane, on the one end, to thick pyrolysis tar, which you could use to make a tar. So that whole range, we tackle and break it down and turn it into saleable products. Some of them you can sell straight out from there, which is like an onion, it goes into fertilizer. Others need to go quite a few steps further to actually purify them sufficiently and then sell them as saleable products. And the list of material that comes out is what we have in those white boxes. So, Madam Chair, to come back to your question specifically on propylene. Yes. So as part of this range that comes out of the reactor of products, one of those products is propylene. Now, you first have to clean it up. Polymers need 99.9% purity propylene. To do that out of that soup of products in itself is an exercise. And then when we turn it into polypropylene, you do polymerization reactor and the polymer comes out. Now at the point where it's propylene sufficiently separated from the other products, you can also make petrol and diesel from that. Now at that juncture, the propylene has a certain value. And we need to, over time, first of all, decide which investments do we make. Do we either turn it into fuel or do we turn it into a chemical? But our decision, we would argue, clearly depends on the value of propylene at that juncture. If we can't make a profitable polymer with what we call the fuel value of propylene, then why should we be making an investment that's loss-making? Then we would rather turn it into fuel and address the country's fuel balance. So when we say our polymer business, and in particular polypropylene, has been making a loss in those years, then it is because if one takes that fuel value and then you take the revenue we earn on that business and put that over the amount of capital we invested to do all of that, it's actually not making a profit. So in economic terms, just about every year we're not making it. In accounting terms, we're in and out, and particularly the years after the Great Recession, so we've been making an accounting loss. Now, I'll jump ahead a bit and I might just come back to that when we close off again, but that is why we are saying, well, we are not in a position really to take our polymer prices down further. We're already making a loss in that business. And we made a significant investment, which was in the order of 400 billion rand, and that was quite some time ago, so the numbers today would probably double in that. And we've got to make the best of it. That's the risk that we take. We don't argue about that. That's what we're in business for. But we, and I'll come to this point just now, I'd really like to come in. What we would like to get is what we call the market price. and we allow the market to set the price. And that is why the context of the WTO signing and the opening up of the polymer market to imported competition is important to understand. And that is why the polymer business, and it's not just South Africa, this is how the polymer business works globally. And that's how we are accepted it, that's the risk we take, and that's the price we get. The pricing concepts that are otherwise being put forward, to our knowledge, would make South Africa the only country in the world that prices polymers like that. Mining companies might price like that, which might be the case. And it certainly would lead to us making a loss, which really would even under greater pressure for the investment in the polymer business. So, Madam Chair, have I addressed your question sufficiently? Is there anything else you'd like to...
Put it this way, you have addressed it in the central way. I'm not satisfied. But I don't want us to delay here because that will take another hour on economic discussion. So I want us to move on because I think you are doing your best.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before moving off, maybe just that one then. I'd like to actually move on to the next slide, thanks, Johan. The outcome of opening up and dropping the trade barriers is that we really see competition from all regions in the world, and particularly Asia and the Middle East. So the Middle East, in particular, has, of course, got a balance of oil and gas, and they've been building huge export-based industries. And the only region that can in any way compete with them on a cost basis at the moment is the United States and the US Gulf, and it's a consequence of the shale gas revolution that's been going on in North America. Now that's the competition that we face, and I've mentioned it earlier, the Indian Ocean Rim and East Asia have the lowest polymer prices in the world, so the producers in that region that we compete against come from that base and try and sell. The important point about this dynamic is that the converter is the decision taker on the price. We don't actually set the price. We compete at the polymer converter's gate for her or his business. So if the converter, and they have that on an ongoing basis, gets an offer from a South Korean or a Middle Eastern producer for polymer delivered at their gate, we compete against that, and by any commercial process, that's a negotiation that happens, and the competitor will decide to either buy the imported product or our product. Now, clearly, we've got an interest to want to get that business, and so we price accordingly to get the business, but we get driven down by the imported product price. And that's a dynamic that happens at every converted case. And what it also facilitates is that the offer can be more broad than just price. I think we all know that converters are entrepreneurs. They run small businesses. So for some, sometimes it's important for them to get given different terms of payment. I'll come to that just now, but all our rebate system and all of that can actually play out to provide converters on a specific way support so that they can actually grow their business. Because their success is, we rely on them being successful for our business. Success. Yes. So coming to the specific pricing aspects of our pricing policy, we provide a number of rebates to our customers. A very important one in particular in propylene is the export incentive program. And how this works is as follows. If a converter is able or interested in actually making a product and exporting it, we provide that converter a reduced price of export rebate to enable that sale to happen. And it's working quite successfully. Clearly, we would like to see more, and we would like to see our converters to be even more successful so that we can actually sell more to our converters. We can then actually sell into the export market rather than us exporting the product. The import replacement support is a rebate that we provide to specific customers which are in sectors where imports are posing a particular threat. Now, in this instance, I can mention one example which we are quite aware of, and that's the housewares market. And China, over the last few years, has aggressively been stepping up their sales of houseware products. And what I mean by that is typically like an Addis type of Tupperware container, which gets made from a machine called an injection molder. And the reason why the South African converters are finding it particularly hard to compete with the Chinese converters in this area is that it's a volume game. And I'll show you later on how big the Chinese market is. And the Chinese has aggressively been investing in that sector. So they have not only their huge own domestic markets to supply, but then can, on a marginal basis, attack export markets like the South African one. So for South African converters, who have a much smaller home base, it's much more difficult to go into that investment. And the capital component in economy of scale is a significant asset influences this particular market. Market development support is support we give to customers who come up with a particular market development, slightly different to product development, and we would give them support to enter in a particular market. So quite some time ago, but it's a good example to use. Ice cream wasn't sold in these Tupperware tubs that you use now. It was more in a paper type of cotton form. And if somebody would come along and say, well, I've got a new market, I'd like to use polypropylene in the ice cream tub market, then we would certainly help that customer with a price to get a foothold and get that market established. That example ran quite closely with the product-specific development, and this is a case where we've helped manufacturers to develop a specific polypropylene grade which is then robust enough at low temperatures to actually sell ice cream effectively. And so we've provided, in that instance, a development support. This development support doesn't only go to price, but we've also actually done the technical support of that. Over the paint is some context of how big these markets are and how small the South African market is. So the South African market, at the moment, to our estimate, is about 270,000 tons a year. The Chinese market is 19.1 billion tons a year. So that makes up about 1.5% of the Chinese market. And I think the graph just shows how overwhelmingly big that market is. Even compared to Nigeria, then we're comparable, but the United States is already at 5 million tons, India 3.5. Over the page, another aspect that's quite important in the polymer business, and that is the scale of plants. Now, generally an operation like this has two types of costs, which are fixed costs and variable costs. So variable costs are what you pay per ton, and the more you make, the more you pay in that category. Fixed costs are the costs which stay fixed regardless of how much you produce. The larger your plant is, the lower your fixed cost per ton is, because that's the same amount you pay. The larger you make the plant, you employ the same number of people, you've got the same number of equipment, it just gets a bit bigger. Now, the frontier of technology has been pushing further and further. On this graph, we've got our two polypropylene plants, which are similar. The most recent one is 300,000 tons, and it was built in 2004. Today, there are plants running that are larger than 450,000 tons. So in 10 years, the increase here has been 50%, which means the fixed cost portion of those producers is a 30%, in the order of 30% lower than ours. This is just the dynamic of the polymer business. It might, to some, seem as a mature industry, but if you see this sort of technology development going on, it's clearly still a growth market in as far as technology goes.
Does the 300,000 tons refer to maximum annual production?
Yes. Come to close, Madam Chair. The second to last slide is really one which we would like to convey the value chain and its importance to us, but also what are the factors that play a part in making a value chain competitive. The committee will have heard from various parties actually talking to this topic, that it's not just about the price. and very important on transport costs, for instance, to understand the dynamics of that. I've previously mentioned that it costs $15 a ton to move a ton of polymer from Durban to Hong Kong. It costs about $45 a ton to move it from Johannesburg to Durban. It is actually cheaper to move to Hong Kong to Cape Town, because Cape Town is about 8 to 900 grams. So in the discussion on beneficiation, it's important to understand how the world has changed. In the 70s, inward industrialization programs was really an international phenomenon. It wasn't just South Africa. So we said Brazil, India, other countries, they were really focusing inwards with huge tariff barriers protecting their business. The world has now changed, and we believe from a trade policy point of view for the better, but it means you have to be able to compete. If one doesn't take into account how close Hong Kong is, actually, and that for some half-time producers, Hong Kong is closer than Johannesburg or Melbourne Straits, then we actually would be missing a very important aspect about understanding how beneficiation would work. So the skill component in what you can do, and better, can do better than others, has become much more important as the cost of freight has actually come down. The international portion of this, that is. The domestic part is far too high in South Africa, so it penalizes us on the export leg, and competition that's coming in from abroad has to pay even more to compete against South African producers or just to bring their product in. And those are key aspects which to our assessment are far more important at the moment than having such a sharp focus on the material price and how it's in this polymer process. Our port charges, I understand, are the highest in the world. And moving the polymer price by an X percentage point is really not going to have the impact of it that you would get in the value chain by addressing these factors which we're highlighting here. And indeed, without addressing these factors, we argue that the polymer price difference is not going to bring much to the value chain. The infrastructure aspect is important. The availability of power. Our understanding from our customers is that they are continuing to invest in machinery. It's important for them to compete, clearly with the world that keeps on investing, but part of the investments has to go into ensuring continued power supply, which is really putting them at a disadvantage, just to ensure that they've got secure electricity. Labor skill and stable labor is very important. South Africa has a shortage of that, and to our understanding, that one of the constraints throughout in South Africa is skilled labor. So addressing that in the sector is also of critical importance. Administered prices, the extent to which they rise, you will have heard before, in particular the reference here to electricity prices. And indeed, we do see that the polymer price is part of that. We wouldn't want to say that the polymer price isn't relevant. But the important aspect about where we've arrived at this point in South Africa as far as polymer prices goes is that the profitability of the upstream is now at the point where that is jeopardizing any further ongoing investment in the polymer industry. Polymer producers have zero tariff protection. The downstream still has 20% tariff protection. What we are arguing for is that the upstream and downstream should be borne in mind if one looks at the value chain. One can't expect a flourishing downstream sector if you don't have a profitable upstream sector. Security of supply, to our understanding of the polymer market, is the most important aspect for any entrepreneur who starts a business. The price actually comes after that. If they don't know that they need the polymer, they wouldn't want to start building a factory. So our view and point we would really want to make here is that we understand the importance of the downstream. We develop our market. We support the technical support. But we have arrived at a point where the upstream is actually at the point where it doesn't make any profit anymore. So as our plants are coming up for renewal, and indeed our PVC plant is now just about 40 years old, we are faced with the question of putting up a huge asset renewal project or actually divert the material to something else, and it's not clear which way it's going to go. So in conclusion, Madam Chair and members, I'd like to recap on what we think are the important points of this presentation. So that since the opening of the South African economy and that we've really joined the world economy, polymer prices are set in line with international markets. And that's important that I'd like to point out here. If one compares South African polymer prices with Asian prices, we are highly comparable to Chinese prices on a delivered basis. That means a price to somebody on the East Rand at the gate, if you compare that with a producer in Guangdong province who also had to import product through Hong Kong, those prices are actually quite comparable. Our prices are generally lower than European prices and United States prices. So that's important to understand, and that there are other factors which are driving the competitiveness of our conversion sector. The competitiveness depends on a number of them, I've just mentioned them, and that, one more time, the long-term sustainability of this value chain depends on both parties being able to reward their investments. So for South Africa to realize its comparative advantage, which we have through all the natural resources that we have, we need to complement this with an increase in our competitiveness in a number of factors so that we can actually be successful. Thank you, Madam Chair.
We must actually thank you. And Justin, is that Mr. Chase? Is that right? The Vice President, Group Regulatory and Stakeholder Affairs. As I said to you, you certainly have given us what I think the CESL has agreed to give us. But there are a lot of questions remain. But let me quickly refer to the committee, who may not share the same view that I have. Yes, Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Mkongi, Honourable Lienye. In that order, please.
Before I ask my main questions, where's your main listing?
Johannesburg.
Yes. Okay. So, a couple of questions then. You produce entirely in rand, as I understand. None of your inputs are imported, certainly in this product.
For the bigger part, yes, we do import some of our catalysts, but the overwhelming part of the production cost, that's the raw material, is South African.
Okay. Thanks for that clarification. Does that mean that you are now? Does that mean with the devaluation of the rand that you're now profitable in that value chain again? Both the devaluation of the rand and the collapse in the oil price, I would imagine that polypropylene is now, in terms of economic value, a far more profitable business for you than it was, say, 12 months ago. That's the first question. Secondly, just let me know if I'm straying too close to the proviso that you made at the beginning. What percentage of your final price is made up of transport and freight? On average, I know it won't be possible to get it exact, so just on average. And then, what has been the effect on your price overall since 2009, since the end of the import tariffs? Are you able to suggest there's been a certain X percentage average decline in your price? And then lastly, who do converters actually buy from? Do they buy from you directly, or is there a chain of suppliers and bulk suppliers and people or whatever in the market? If I open a factory to make these water bottles, would I buy directly from Settle or would I buy from someone else? And if you can just take us through that supply chain.
Right, thank you very much. I just want to correct something because this is on Hansard. I believe it's Mr. Nick Behrens who gave us the bulk of the presentation.
Indeed, it's Norbert. Norbert Behrens.
Norbert, yes. Senior Vice President, Strategic Projects. My apologies to you. Honourable Mkongi.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. I hope my apology was extended to the meeting. Okay, no, thank you very much. Now I have some few questions in welcoming the presentation from Sasa. The part that is interesting me in this presentation, which you began with, was the question of that demand for polymer is inelastic. Now, we are talking about the elasticity of demand. That depends on a number of factors in the market or in the economic cycle. Now, there is a question here that you are raising. You are saying that when the price of oil is rising, it influences the end product, which is the price of polymer. Yeah. Now, you are raising again that we do have a capability through the extraction of coal that we can be able to produce polymer at the end of the day. And so we have that capability. Now, if we have that capability and we agree that the price of coal is constant, if we agree that the price of coal is constant, so if we have a capability of transforming coal into polymer with a constant price, what makes us to rely on the oil? That will make us to be vulnerable to price fluctuations internationally. Why do we stick on the capabilities that we have as a country and produce, I mean, extract coal and process it into a final good? And within that process of transformation of coal, there is an amount of job creation, there is an amount of skills development, there is an amount of building capabilities in terms of research and development in South African youth, etc. Why do we want to rely on that? That is the first question that I wanted to ask. The second question is the competition in terms of the convergence between ourselves and other countries. Before I can go there, I want to, why don't we divert and assist South Africa in its program? Because one of the tenets of our program is regional integration in Africa and regional development. Now, we are saying that China is flooding the market in terms of the Tupperware production and the sales of those Tupperware in the world. Why don't we shift our focus in to Africa and go up Africa and make sure that we occupy that particular market? What are the challenges that makes us not to be able to do that in order for us to be able to support our national goals? The last question, which I'm very interested in, is how, because you know, the case that you put in front of the committee, we used to say a case of sport, but your case is a case for the upstream. That is the case that you're putting. Now, I'm asking that the relationship between the profitability of the upstream, which is threatened by the flourishment of the downstream, is that the argument? Is that the flourishing of the downstream beneficiation threatens success of the upstream beneficiation? Is that what you're trying to argue?
Honorable Yenge, I'm just looking at your mic. Well, I want that ghost to remove himself.
I'm sure that my colleagues have helped me. I was just trying to quite understand, but you were asking, maybe if you could just repeat the question, the flourishing of the downstream, could that, which you closed off with, could you just repeat that question?
Is that what you are saying, that threatens the profitability of the upstream beneficiaries? So what are the constraints? Because our understanding is that the flourishing of the downstream beneficiaries is equally beneficial to the success of the upstream. Yeah, because in this case, it supports the national goals of the national development plan. So that is what I wanted to ask. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Honorable Nkongi. Honorable Yenge.
Yeah, thank you, Jefferson. Let me welcome and appreciate the presentation by Sasso, of which it's something that we think is going to assist us going forward in terms of the appreciation and the understanding that Sasol has. But I want to go further and say, anything that you do, there will always be advantages and disadvantages. Now, going forward, in order to achieve your set goals, in order to contribute in total efficiency, do you envisage any threats that will come your way? And if so, do you have any remedial methods in terms of ensuring that you don't deviate from your focal point, that of saying we are contributing to this beneficiation? Then secondly, the long-term sustainability of the conversion value chain on polymer is something that is very critical, and we would want to see the benefit goes to rural communities as well as a job creation mechanism. Do you have a method that will definitely uplift the lives of the poorest, of the poor, in achieving that line? And lastly, the profitability that is economically around this. In Africa, what is your general view in terms of you attaining your set goals? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Kornhoff.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just remind me, the Sasol fuel output is what percentage of the total consumption in South Africa?
About 25.
Quick response. How much?
25%.
Thank you very much. And then I do get the impression that fuel prices or energy prices in the United States is fairly low in comparison to South Africa, or is it also linked to the global oil price market? If it's not, why not? And if it's not, what will you do with your fuel prices in Lake Charles? Will it be priced in a similar way to being priced in South Africa, or will you have to adapt to the American way?
Thank you very much. Now, we'd like very succinct response for yourself, from yourself. We are having to close this report next week, but any expansion should be given to us in writing by Monday.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to start with the questions from Honourable Hinduas around the valuation of rand and the oil price and the possibility of polypropylene. Your first question was in the context of costs and how we run the business, so that's in rands, and as I answer this. But I think, as we all aware, the petrol price is set connected to the international price, so that will be driven by petrol prices, which in international petrol prices, which are driven by oil price in the first instance, and then the exchange rate. So the profitability of Sasol, and the same applies for any products that are sold as part of a global market, will move in line with the exchange rate and the international product price. So the profitability, for instance, I think you have the question, is if the oil price is increasing, and is the polymer price increasing, what is the outcome of that? Or more specifically, now that we're seeing a drop in the oil price, are we seeing that the polymer price is actually becoming more profitable because the feedstock costs going into polymers is actually dropping? And that is correct. This drop we've seen in the oil price now is actually opening up the margin for polymer producers, and we expect to see that, although it's still fairly recent, all of this, to see that coming through in our polymer business. The percentage of freight is, as I've been pointing out, comparatively small. Of course, it depends on where you take it. But if you take the numbers that I've given earlier on for FEX in South Africa, so if the polymer price is in the order of 15,000 rand, then we're talking of a freight leg to Durban of about 500 rand. So that gives you a percentage of what's that, 3%, or is it, etc. 2.5% on average. I have my colleague. And then on the international basis, the polymer producers that are sent into South Africa from coming from South Korea, their freight cost is as low as about 7 or 8% of the total delivered price at which they can make an offer in South Africa. So from our point of view, the freight cost contribution is actually small in the final product price. Do they buy directly from us, the interface question that you asked? Polymer converters buy above a certain volume, and the number is 20 tons per month, and that's driven by the size of the truck. We deliver directly to their gas on whatever the request is, and we deliver on a 48-hour notice, it's a matter of picking up the phone call, and we deliver the products directly to them. Polymer producers are buying less, polymer converters are buying less than that amount. We tend to supply it through a wing of our polymers marketing business, which deals with small volume customers. The reason for that is that they also just need a different type of customer support. They can come and fetch their polymer if they'd like to. So it's anything from people buying two bags in a month, whatever you come and collect or you drop it with our key. But that service is also provided by others, which is more like a distributed service. But we would also supply, in fact, directly to converters from us. Importers, if I can add that, you get a combination. You either get traders who set them up as agents, and they might buy a product from their principals in the Middle East and then sell it. And what we've seen over the last number of years, which makes the important offer more competitive, is that they actually warehouse the product in Durban. So they've got their own warehouse here, and they can also deliver 14 hours ex stock on imported material. Does that answer your question? Sorry. No, I'm getting support as we're going along. Thanks for that. I don't feel better at all. Thanks. Thanks for your sympathy, Namitin. To Honourable Nkongi, and the questions on the constant cost of coal, and given the price movements and the cost of coal not actually changing in line with the world price, economic policy and approach of South Africa is actually to have an open economy. So we compete against importing in all products, and it's not just the petrochemical industry that does that. And the reason for that is that you actually get a better outcome by being in direct competition with the international markets. So if I can take Sasol as an example, if we wanted to follow the approach which you're questioning or putting in your question, which is we start with coal and we know what that cost is, and we then essence all the cost and then we sell at a certain price. And if you have had to reward the capital that goes into building all of that, you would very often be charging a higher petrol price than you are getting in the market today. And that's why we also see the same in polypropylene. You made a point that we can go from coal to polypropylene, which is correct. If there would be an economic policy in which investors of capital get rewarded for the risk they take, and in building that technology, the price that you'd have to put down and recover for most, or very often, would be higher than the price than you get in the market right now. So that's a fact. The current policy keeps us under pressure the whole time, and that's a fact for the global commodity industry overall. And it's all commodities in general follow a downward trend in real terms of world prices. They're actually in real terms getting lower. Well, as it swings and roundabouts, it makes it a little more difficult, I have to admit. But if you look at the long-term trend since 1910, in real terms, those products have been falling by 1% a year. And it's because of this free market that everybody's under pressure to always cut costs, and we do that relentlessly in our organization as well. The regional development question in Africa is something that we would certainly, we've got the same question as you. We'd really like to have Africa as our backyard, so to speak, and export into that region. Unfortunately, the African market is small, and we are already struggling with economies of scale and comparison numbers. So if I can pick a number, our pre-currency mark is about 230. I'm speaking under correction, Malawi is probably 20,000 tons. It's probably the order of magnitude, those than ours. If you add all of the sub-Saharan Africa, you still end up with a small number, and you've got to take all the product out there. We supply those markets, definitely. We're very active in those markets. But at the moment, we're still just at the low end of the growth curve to be able, that's preventing us to really go out there and actually make investments.
Unfortunately, we have run out of time because we've done this more than an hour, and we do have other pressures on us. So we started at 8:45, it's now 10 o'clock. So what I'd like to do is to thank you very much for that, but we haven't completed your responses. As you yourself know, we would like you to back up what you have already indicated to us in writing, as well as the rest of the responses. And we would appreciate it if we could have it Monday afternoon. Because I know it's all there, and a lot of it is in your presentation, but as we come to the end, so that it's just quite clear. Certainly, I can't speak for committee because they'll still be commenting on this report. I, one, cannot accept that we are obliged to charge a market price on the fuel aspect, even though we have made it ourselves, unless the production of that fuel from coal is the same as what we would import it for. And I don't believe that that's the case any longer. It certainly may have been the case in the earlier years. So I do want that question addressed, because I cannot understand why this is not the case put that way. So is there anything else you would like to say, Mr. Munger from DTI?
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and the members. I think coming on from this detail, we probably want to say we would want to engage that's going further on our expectations as a country in terms of their contribution to the industrialization and to their benefit, their contribution to the general economy. As you said, I would concur with what you said. You're not satisfied. I think they know from us, not as we think that we've got certain issues that we're not happy with. And would appreciate is an environment where at the very highest level in SASOL, they understand the responsibility that rests with them. And they're probably their legacy burden or their legacy in terms of what we expect of them in South Africa. And we are always engaging them. It cannot be concluded here, but we would want to engage them on that.
Thank you. One of the issues we are looking at is parity pricing issue, and issues around the whole iron and steel issue within the country, as well as this one. We need Sasol. Sasol is a South African company, and to be congratulated for how far they've got, but we need you to become part of South Africa in everything you do, while of course extending yourself into foreign markets at the same time. We need Sasol to benefit the manufacturing processes in our country. But we are going to wait. I can't, as I say, speak for the committee, but we are going to await your responses in writing. And I want to thank you for making a second trip down here. We also want to respect the issues raised in your letter as well. Thank you very much, all of you.
Thank you. Thank you,
Madam Chair. Members, I want to just introduce you.
Just note that the leadership of Sasol is completely white. Actually, I was giving them the benefit of
doubt. I thought the gentleman from GTI is one of them, but I saw him sitting far from there, so I was not quite sure whether he's not quite at home or where, but now I realize he's not one of them. I hope they have a strategy of working on that, otherwise it doesn't create a good impression. I mean, we have so many university students that are struggling to find a niche in developing the country. I don't know whether there's a response to that, but of course I know there's no time.
I do want to thank you, Honourable Mabasa. Honourable Mabasa used to be in the Trade and Industry Committee. He now is the whip of our new ministry, not the ministry, but the portfolio committee, and that is small business. Am I correct on that, Honourable Mabasa? So he has inside experience of trade and industry as it were. I think that I'm going to allow you to make a quick response, but I want to move on, please.
Chair, thank you very much. And we note the comment. I know that Mel and I, we work so hard on the lack of getting into sun, so we are in fact qualify on the employment equity side, so we have about 40% there. We hope that in the next time that we are here, we'll be better presented. Let's regard.
Thank you. We know the issue of gender has to some extent been addressed, but our main concern, which we've got in a recommendation in the budget review, is that where are the black industrialists? Are you telling me 20 years later we can have bankers, we can have scientists, we can't have industrialists? And I think that's an issue for all the companies, not just Tesla. So next time, please unwrap such people and bring them here. Thank you. Because I really need that. We'd like to see them. Members, I am very sorry. We are delayed here because we had to wait to just get a few people. Honourable Mabasa, thank you very much. Honourable Mabasa is here, joining us in this committee, but as I indicated before, he is coming with great interest from his own committee, Small Business Portfolio Committee, because their budget is still, in a sense, managed within the ETI until a particular period. And what I would like to do, members, on the budget review recommendation report to the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry, today's date would come in, I'd like us to study the intro, and then I'd like us to move to the conclusion, because that's where the substance of what we have not engaged with is. So other parties have had this. The person who has not had this is the Honourable Mabasa. So we're looking at page one, Honourable Mabasa, page one. On page one, we have an intro. First part of that, we then have several bullets. Some of you may not have realized, but it is 20 years in terms of this BRRR. Just a minute. Yeah, because that is a milestone. The issue, though, as some of you, in fact, no one in the committee other than the Honourable Mabasa, who was in the early years of trade and industry 5 years ago, you will recall, I've actually asked this, uninvited spirit to leave us, and he is still remaining, but he's interested in, you can see, value addition. The issue of trade and industry, you will remember, Honourable Mabasa, when you, in 2009, when we did gambling, we learned that, by the way, that was under general services at the time, and not DTI. You will recall when we, with Chris Fisher as the minister. I just mentioned, in 20 years, the DTI has evolved from the mandates included under general services And Ms. Erling will continue that sentence. And?
And of finance and trade and industry.
To a department now with an architect more focused on its primary mandate of XYZ. Although President Zuma has proclaimed a ministry of small business, would you continue? I can't see the screen from here.
Okay. So the replacement is the Small Business Development Department purchase for the DGI on vote 36, and a separate budget for vote for the new department will be established in the 2015-16 financial year.
Now, I have to just look at the Honourable Mabasi here, who comes from small business. So if we look at Honourable Mabasi, is we saying, although the President has proclaimed the Ministry of Small Business Development Department, although the President has proclaimed the Ministry of Small Business, the Small Business Development Department coexists with the DTI on vote 36, coexists in the DTI budget, on, you know, vote 36. Do we all get that clear? The funds are full captured there. Okay? A separate budget vote for the new department will be established in 2015-2016. That we ascertain from Treasury, from Finance, is not a DTI decision per se. It's not a small business decision. So I hope that that clarifies the issue there. In terms of the technicalities, Honourable Mabasa, we do agree. Thank you very much. We then move on to the next paragraph or bullet. The recognition of structural economic challenges called for a decisive break from jobless economic growth to an employment-generating economy, from an economy characterized by exclusion to an inclusive and equitable economy, which is directed at eliminating poverty. We didn't say is eliminating, but we said is directed at that, because we have to follow it. We did, Honourable and Company.
Why don't you say a decisive break with past off?
Right, a decisive break from jobless economy. You want interspersed into that decisive break from the past jobless economic growth. Can we move with that? No objection. We have done 1.1, and now Ms. Hurley will put in red anything that has been added since you last saw this report. But I immediately want to go to the conclusion where the majority of the challenges have been captured. And that is six, well, I don't know, your pages will be different from mine, 59. You'll see at the bottom of page 59, and we do have to go through these, there are quite a lot of changes. Based on its deliberations, the committee drew the following conclusions. Energy supply constraints are still a major barrier to industrialization and economic growth. Remain a major barrier. Government should create the necessary environment to mitigate negative implications for industrial policy. The committee welcomes Honourable Tongi
to receive with necessary environment or an enabling environment.
The second bullet, the committee welcomes the government's plans to improve its energy mix in order to provide a more reliable supply of energy. The current energy pricing, particularly electricity within certain municipalities, is excessive for industry and the success of industrialization in South Africa. Ideally, the price of energy, including municipal electricity surcharges and prospective, do you call it prospective price of nuclear energy without wasting time on semantics, or do we call it potential or future? I'm not going to argue about the word, but I'm saying that, you know, prospective reminds, sort of makes me think we're prospecting for metals or something. So I think we ought to improve there. Should not at any stage, this is nuclear energy as well, compromise the success of industry. Industrialization. Much broader. Therefore, government should ensure that financing models should not inadvertently burden end users, particularly industry. You know, when we say industry, the whole issue is this, Ms. Herling, we need to capture, and it's not just you, of course, I know Ms. Herling as well, we need to capture the fact, this is IPAP we're talking about. When we talk of industry, not many people think of agriculture. So, if we can just fix that to ensure that it's more inclusive, are you able to do that as we move on? However, the committee is of the opinion that all stakeholders should consider the full range of alternative energy solutions. The committee welcomes the adjustments to the port charge structure in favor of value-added exports. However, port charges remain excessive for manufactured and processed goods. And the delays experienced in the movement of goods at the ports compromises efficiency. The committee acknowledged the increasing global pressure from developed countries for products with lower carbon footprints. However, the possible imposition of a carbon tax poses a significant threat to industrialization. The committee encourages government and business to invest in carbon emission-reducing technologies. Labour unrest arising from poor working conditions and the rising wage gap has resulted in protracted and sometimes violent strikes in recent years. This has become an impediment to inclusive economic growth and industrialization. South Africa needs to remain attractive to foreign direct investment. Therefore, the committee believes that South Africa needs a stable labour environment with decent wages and working conditions, to improve productivity as an integral part of social compact. The committee welcomes the additional allocations to the Export Promotion and Marketing Sub-Program with Trade and Investment South Africa, which has received a nominal increase of 36% in the 2014-2015 budget. For you, Honourable Hill Lewis, you may not have been informed that your colleague did request for further funds here, and we found out, in fact, further funds have just been allocated in this direction.
Chair, I just wanted to make a closing question, because to what extent does the budget release on Wednesday impact on this report? And basically, answer there, I'll just make comments on that.
If I may, I'll comment on that as I reach the end of conclusions. It does require a comment.
The thing is, in the adjusted estimates of national expenditure, TISA has actually received a budget decrease. So they've had funds moved from that program, which is why I still have that concern. Because even though they did receive the 36% nominal increase in the midterm budget, it's now been decreased.
Right. Can I flag that? Right. Investment promotion is essential for technology transfer, job creation and economic growth. TISA currently has 45 foreign missions in traditional and strategic markets. However, the DTI should ensure the presence of an adequate number of officials with the requisite expertise at the foreign missions. I think the entire committee holds very strongly about that. The service delivery performance of subsea is not yet optimal, particularly the accessibility of the call center and the availability of subsea's new website. This matter needs to receive greater attention and focus on subsea and continued oversight by the DTI. The committee supports the rollout of additional walk-in centers to assist the move towards a paperless electronic system and to improve turnaround times. Given that subsea is self-funding, and this is important, and does not receive transfers from DTI, the committee supports its request for permission from National Treasury to use some of its surplus for special projects such as IT improvements. A critical part of successful industrialization drives domestic demand for locally manufactured products. There is a need to raise awareness and raise the purchasing of local products among South African consumers. In addition, National Treasury should promote and enforce local public procurement for designated products to achieve the 75% target set by the President. The committee is also of the view that to ensure compliance with local procurement requirements, and this is important again, it's new for the committee, the audit's opinion, this is an additional request, should reflect the purchase of locally produced goods. Locally produced, D, by departments and entities. But that would also grow the small businesses around the place, and I think it's very important that one, if people were... as this was emphasized. The capacity to verify local content there underpins the ability of National Treasury to monitor this, the agency to audit the information, and because of that, the committee supports the review. The review. You will recall we said review then because we already knew that things in the budget may not be as extensive, the expenditure, as we may have hoped, of the resource allocation to entities responsible for providing local content verification. Nevertheless, that's important. The committee emphasized the need for broadening economic participation, particularly the development of black industrialists and rural areas, two separate issues. The committee further acknowledged the development of an incentive for black industrialists, which should promote the emergence of more black-owned manufacturing businesses. It also welcomed, and I'm pointing also to the Honourable Mabasi here, see if there's something else that we shouldn't add, welcomed the creation of Small Business Development Department, which will more intensely support small enterprise and cooperative development, which is internationally acknowledged as a significant employment generator. You wish to add anything else there? Just let me check with Honourable Arthur first.
No, the last phrase, if you could repeat that, please, Commissioner.
It also welcomes the creation of the SBD, which will more intensely support small enterprises and cooperative development, which is internationally acknowledged, yeah.
Without having the proper ways, if we could also include job creation.
Yes, employment generators. This phrase, significant employment generators. It's internationally acknowledged, because that's the reality. All right? Several pieces of new or amended legislation. Sorry, Honourable Mkongi.
Fine to say welcome to the creation of the Department of Small Business Development. I'm saying of the Small Business Development Department.
Just
there we said we welcome the creation of the Small Business Development Department. I'm saying, is it not cool to say creation of the Department of Small Business Development? That we say Department of Small Business Development. I would say
You see, because there are abbreviations that are being used for departments, which confuses how you put a particular department. You can't say this department is Department of Industry and Trade. Because if you are saying it's Department of Industry and Trade, it's not about GTI, it's DIG. This is what I'm trying to raise there. So it's the creation of the Department of Small Business Development.
I tell you what, let me either be an alarm stop to confirm that title, because I can't comment there, I must be honest. Thank you. Then there was something else, but let me deal with it. Now, it was on TISA. It was not cut from previous year.
Well,
at the previous year end, we transferred, this is from the department, savings across the department to TISA to cover the foreign expenditure. However, if one examines the original budget compared to this year's budget, it is not cut. What they're saying, what was the original budget? It was X. That hasn't changed. We haven't cut that. What they did do, and why it may appear from the expenditure to be higher, is that there were savings in other programs. What did they do with the savings? They transferred it to TISA. That's what. So it was savings from other programs.
What about it has been shifted away from TISA now?
Well, that didn't belong to TISA in the first place. Do you see?
It was given to TISA at some point, I don't know when, and now it's been taken away.
It was given because it was saving. At the end of that year, it was savings. The department is entitled to up to a certain percentage to take a decision on its savings, and it decided to transfer it to TISA, give it to TISA for extra expenditure, but it wasn't the original allocation in that year. I know, I can see you're not entirely happy, but okay, thank you. Several pieces of new or amended legislation have been assented to recently, such as BBBEE, the Intellectual Property Laws Amendment, the National Credit Amendment, and the Special Economic Zones Act. The committee awaits the finalization of the related regulation and implementation of these pieces of legislation. Furthermore, the committee awaits the tabling of the Promotion and Protection of Investment Bill and the Gambling Amendment Bill, which is critical to close legislative gaps and create an optimum and robust regulatory environment for business and consumers. We've got a couple of these in highlighted, and can you explain why this is highlighted this early?
But we have this was additions not properly discussed at the meeting on Wednesday. So
the AMC, yeah. All right, the AMC and some. Yes, Mr. Honourable.
I don't mind with that, but I honestly agree. Are we sure that new legislation, certain entities will have expanded money? Because if that is the case, I would like us to use might.
That's why I was going to say when we reach the end, I don't want bullets. What I want to see here is 6.12345, because now I don't know what bullet you're referring to. Which bullet?
The highlight, the first highlight.
Quite obviously, I'm waiting for the explanation, you see, which I've just got, and I'm saying that this came from the AMC or the chairperson. So AMC in some cases, the chairperson in other. Now, your question is, are we sure they'll have expanded mandates? Well, they have said so, and Minister has said so, and the legislation So maybe mandate is not the right word. Perhaps we should use function. Yes, Honourable.
Thanks, sir. I think the debate that we had, as a committee, it was a concern with regards to the functioning and sustainability of the entities, not to maybe indicating a will that we want expansion or there is expansion. There is no indication even from the department to say we want to expand, but a reconsideration of the functioning and the sustainability of entities.
Right. There are two issues in that. The first issue is related to the issue of the legislation calling for further functions to be undertaken. That's a reality. That's a reality. The other one, which I want your statement, Honourable Lihenge, to lean itself towards, is the broader comment. But when legislates that X will be done, there will be an inspectorate, but you don't actually establish one, well, you're undermining your legislation. I'm not suggesting that that's the case here. Yes, Honourable Mkombi.
Yeah, that is why I want us to be careful, especially on the question of the separation of powers. Because if the executive say it will, it does not necessarily mean other legislature are going to affect it. So that is why I'm saying, it's necessary for us to say might, to give a space for the debate and the conclusion. So instead of saying will, we say might, because it's still going to be debated.
The problem is it's not a debate, it's law. It is law. You see, the law will take effect on a particular date, but it's in the law that a particular function has been added. This is what I'm talking specifically about one entity. Let's just take the NCR. It will have this extra function. That's the reality. It's not a debate. So it's legislated for. So that's the challenge. That's why I wanted to separate the two points. The one point is very specific, but I'm saying it's not a mandate, actually. It's a function. So we clear the one up, we change the word mandate to functions, because it's the law that has devised those functions, has increased them. You see? Yes, well, are you busy tapping away? Who's cleaning it up? There we are. Thank you. Right. Now we come to the second one, which could be the one which addresses your issue. The committee is concerned. See, we've got some visitors at the top. Most unfortunately, we haven't introduced the practice of informing the chair as to who is sitting there, but you're very welcome. This is the Committee of Trade and Industry. It also includes the whip, the Honourable Jitlangoma Mabasa from Small Business, because their budget is currently still with the budget of Vote 36. And we're finalising the budget review recommendation report. That will affect lots of issues around credit acts and consumer commission and so on. The committee is concerned that the leadership vacuum due to vacancies in three of the top four executive positions at the NGB, the National Gambling Board, compromises its ability to exercise its mandate effectively. However, we've got two co-administrators currently. However, the committee welcomes the intervention by the minister to suspend the gambling board and effectively address any underlying governance and other issues. We can't say but are there any? Because the decisions aren't, we haven't completed that process. As well as the appointment of the two co-administrators to tend to, the word tend takes you right back to the nursery or incubator. Let's look at another word. To address, to implement, to administer, to address daily operational matters, okay? previously the committee called for the rationalization of the board. This is one of the... This last bullet also relates to your point, Julie. Okay. Honourable Mkongi?
I want us to go back to the highlights. The one of the executive positions, four vacant executive positions. Can you qualify that fair? To say, the committee is concerned that the leadership value due to vacancies in three of the top four compromises its ability. I want to ask something. Is that the only thing? Or is the question of governance administration also? Where? I didn't see governance.
And any underlying governance issue, the last two. Yeah. Remember, the Auditor General also refers to the governance. Yeah. Thank you. Honourable Liyenge? Because this is also related to your point.
Yeah, I think I'm quite covered, Chairperson, with the issue that relates to the concern raised by the committee with regard to the functioning, general functioning of the board. And it also takes into consideration the recent vacancies that are there and therefore the inability. You know, it comes.
Honourable Liyenge, Honourable Mkongi.
Chairperson, we do not also welcome the forensic investigation on all matters relating to the activities of the board during the period under review.
No, but I do believe you got a point, because there is a suspension, but there is also, the minister has called for and established the forensic audit. Is it forensic audit or inquiry, Ms. Erling? Forensic audit. Investigation will cover the audit. Right? Investigation. Inquiry, okay. We should bring Roger in here with all the different words we want to use. Don't look, I hope no one's looking at the door to run out. Previously, the committee, because I'm actually looking at people today. I don't want to see them disappear. Previously, the committee called for the rationalization of the boards of the technical institutions.
Sorry, Chairperson, I'm worried here.
About what?
I'm very worried because we were supposed to contribute some of the things. And I sent my things to the scribers, and they are not considered. Now I'm structurally working. How do I put my issues forward? I can't smuggle them. So I don't know how to do it.
Honourable Mkongi raised it now. Which one is it addressing? Right, please do so.
Okay, Chairman, I think in the meantime, we said meantime that the last one. Okay, thank you. So I wanted also to suggest that we say the committee is of the firm view that the current appointed administrators by the minister should speedily resolve the current pressing matters relating to the leases and reduce the burden imposed to the board due to operating leases.
Just a minute, read it and then hand it over. Read it into the mic, then hand it over.
The second one, question is, the committee is of the considered belief that the matters of this nature should also form part of the terms of reference for forensic investigation.
Just, Benson Keeper, although you should be jumping up here, Denver. Denver's not asleep. I wonder if he needs more sleep. No, right. mind you. Now, that can be done. Ms. Erling, just tap it all in and then we'll look at it. Can we move on? We're waiting for that to be done. Previously, committee called for the rationalization, etc. more effective use of human resources and increased allocative efficiency. More recently, there have been several concerns raised about effectiveness and management of boards of entities. The DTI has indicated, and this was said to us, I don't know if it was by the DG or the minister, that it is engaging on the agency rationalization project to look into the matter. Just to remind members, this is not a DTI agency. It is an agency covering all government entities, because most of the committees called for the rationalization. The committee welcomed this. Welcomed, or do we still welcome it? Welcomed this development and agreed with the AG that the DTI should exercise closer oversight over its entities. That was a criticism raised by the Auditor General. So I think it is pertinent that we pursue that. While that is just continuing, we move to one thing, the recommendations. I'm certainly tired of reminding people that we also have a Deputy Minister. And his name should be here, and I don't see it. I'd like to see it typed in before we leave today. Recommendations. Informed by its deliberations, the committee recommends the House request that the Minister of Trade and Industry should consider. There are only three. Increasing resources with the requisite skills to promote South Africa as an investment destination, and the provision of increased resources, increased not involved, for proudly South Africa, to encourage South Africans to buy locally manufactured products. Second bullet, increasing the financial resources to the National Credit Regulator. And you see what we put here, Honourable Hill Lewis? We're putting over the MPEF period, not 1 year, you see, stretching it. Given the expanded mandate, I'm taking that again, increased or additional functions, all right? And the critical role they play, and the critical role it plays, it's a national credit regulator, it plays in our socio-economic environment. A board is a singular. Third, consulting the Minister of Finance to develop mechanisms to verify and enforce the public procurement of designated products so that the 75% public procurement decision is implemented to underpin the Industrial Policy Action Plan. Now, have we finished what was Honourable Akonki gave, Ms. Hurling? Have we finished it? Right, just put that up. And Ms. Hurling, let me get you to read that. The committee is at it.
The committee is of the view, is of the firm view, that the current administration of NGB should speedily resolve the pressing matters relating to the leases and reduce the burden imposed to the NGB due to these operating leases. The committee also considered the belief that matters of this nature should also form part of the terms referenced for the forensic investigation.
The English, or are we not yet to discuss English? Honourable Mabasa.
I'm on other recommendations.
And we're just finishing on that conclusion. And if I may add, I want those renumbered to reach from 6.1 to 6.16. I don't want to see bullets there, please, when we get that number. And then the appreciation must include the Deputy Minister. Can we see that? Isn't it? Yes,
the fact. I'm saying that the Deputy Minister's name is Mr. Zwandile Masina.
nature may do no harm to have a first mate thrown in down there with everyone. Rob, Lionel, Nzwandile, Joe, yeah. Well, I think that's a good idea.
Another
right.
If we read the committee would like to thank the Minister of Trade and Industry and his deputy as well as the Director General, the Group Chief Operation Officer,
and all other
senior managers.
Avoid
certain challenges which we may encounter now. So don't look too puzzled, because I think Honourable Mabasa and I have an idea where we want to go with this. Honourable Nkongi?
No, Mr. President, I want to disagree with you. I don't want to generalize this matter. I want to leave with a specific matter of business development which is being established out of the DTI. So I want us to write that, to give, you know, the one that we spoke about. It was proactive in a sense that it was talking about the budget that is going to be given in 2015. If you remember when we crafted it before. But now, Honorable Mabasa is talking about the current challenges that they are facing in the establishment of the small business development. So this is what is asking us to deal with that as part of the recommendations to the minister or to the executive. Now, I want us to change that sentence, that the committee... Yes, I guess he's there on the red one to say that concretely, the committee encourages the minister to expedite
It's not exactly what I was pointing out. It's a broader executive decision.
Because the executive authority,
you know, which involves national treasury, etc., is much broader.
Okay. So if we say the executive authority could define it, to expedite that function, that there's a word that is being used, when it moves from one department to another, migrate, yes, to the Department of Small Business Development, a dedicated support system, including funding, should follow those functions with immediate effect.
I want to make this a more general one, because we've had this challenge before, so it's not a fresh thing. Remember I mentioned the economic development. So what we want to do is to use this experience to broaden it. If this happens in any other, yes, Honourable Liye?
I think, Chair, the board mechanism that you are using is actually assisting the process, especially that we are not referring to the minister of this department. We are broadly saying, as this forum, there must be that robust engagement and also the assurance that there should be a flow of resources immediately. I'm sure it covers the aspect, yes. Yeah. We must not be as if we are singling out the Department of Small Business as if it's something that the minister is not done. It's something that the minister cannot decide alone, you know. I think the broadness is actually addressing a lot of issues even in the future, and also considering the fact that that is not happening and there was no robust debate. I think you...
I suppose ever since the second one, because now they've drafted it now, you changed it already from there. Because it's very easy certainly that the executive takes into account that when decisions are taken, no. That is where I differ. To me, it's like it's confrontational, Jefferson. I don't know whether I'm reading wrong that English.
So, if we take part of what you've proposed and put in here, I will have the sentence we want to the position. That takes into account that when functions are migrated, that funds follow functions when they are migrated. That's the issue. That funds follow. Let's use take the word funds out. It's not just the funds, it's the resources. That resources follow functions. That when functions, you know, etc. Let's fix that up, right. Okay, are you happy with that? So we're, yes, fine. Do you see that, Honourable Mabasa? And I think it takes the principle. This has got to be across the board, just as we were opposed to dumping across the board. We're opposed to the situation across the board. members, and I also want to thank the, oh yes, the second one.
The second one is a collaborative spirit between departments, you know, here we can help each other how we can phrase it, but I wanted to specifically thinking of the economic sector departments, especially trade, industry, EDD, and the small business. The collaborative spirit should be encouraged and harnessed, you know, something to that effect.
See, what I found is we didn't have any criticism that it hadn't been done. That's the only issue I have. It never came up. This issue came up throughout the deliberations. But the other ones didn't, you see. And in the same way that we, as the ANC, took out that auto-industry recommendation that the EA had put in, because we said it had never been discussed. This issue has been discussed about resources on the basis. The other one hasn't. In fact, we've been led to believe that it's been okay. And if we are wrong, we must get that clearly, you see. I can't just put it in there without it coming. I hope that's understood. So we're keeping that first one. I'm looking at members. I'm also asking for all the technicalities to be checked in this report. The figures, the titles, you know, these departments, etc. But there's only one thing, and we did do it in a previous report where we did this when the EDD shifted, remember, we did our report with them. We acknowledged the presence of the member. In fact, it was the chairperson who'd come in that case from EDD. We need to acknowledge the presence of the whip of the EDD, who was here, a small business. The previous occasion I have been, but I know you've got your own committee meeting as we talk. Am I correct? Yes. Honourable members, I want to thank you. I need someone now to propose adoption, as we have been through the report before. I also need to make it clear that it is important for all our correspondents with respect to the BRRR to go to small business. Because that is not always happening, I have been informed by the chair. So I asked Honourable Mabase, at least the whip, to be here so that this decision was made with him present at the time. So with respect to this report, we want to make sure that the chairperson and the committee have got a copy of it. And on that note, then we have someone to propose adoption. Thank you, Honourable Mkongi, seconded by. I always prefer a member of the opposition, unless they have a challenge, to second it. Thanks, Honourable Hildewis. But thank you, Honourable Li Yeng. It's just a practice that we have. So we do have a BRRR report. I don't want to see any unhappy faces. Seems really people looking quite concerned. And I want to see if we can't have a short tea break and then come back for renewable power. A short tea break. It's right here. get started. I'm going to ask Deva to call in everyone, please. From that side, that way. Fine. Yes. Actually, you've got a point, Honourable Hill, Liz, and you should tell us, and I mean, that's really very welcome, that he can go in his own chair. You know, we don't mind, do we? See, he saw you in the chair, and he felt someone was already there. Right. Well, we need to move on, and we must thank the renewable energy folks for, you know, being here for some time, waiting, as we did indicate to them at 11 o'clock. Right. And we've got two different people here, that's what's worrying me, but is it Mr. Morgan on the left? Finance manager. Well, yes, I can imagine now why you weren't with us, they're still busy using the calculator. And Mr. Rianka. Hi. Right. The manager here in South Africa for the region. So they are here because when I heard about the wind, and I know for a fact that certainly in the Western Cape it's been used very effectively in a number of areas, and also in Northern Cape the solar can also be used effectively, and for that I'm not talking about houses, I'm talking about plants, factories, etc. So I think we would give them 20 minutes on the matter, and then we will engage with them. So go ahead then, Mr. Rianka.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honourable Members. Thank you for introducing me. I represent the Mainstream South Africa, and my colleague here, Mangalisa Morgan, who's Associate Finance Manager. Okay, so Mainstream is a global company, headquarters in Dublin, Ireland, and we are basically in developing and developed markets, more so focusing on offshore wind farms in Europe, and we've got a large footprint for solar and wind energy in Chile and specifically South Africa as well. We've also embarking on projects in the rest of Africa, and today we're actually launching a project in Ghana as well, a 200 megawatts wind farm in Ghana. Our footprint in South Africa is extensive. We are one of the largest wind and solar developers to date in the country. We've secured 200 megawatts of renewable energy plant, wind and solar, through the Department of Energy's REAP process, of which 240 megawatts are already operating, producing energy to the grid, and 306 megawatts we hope to close in November and the round three process of governance. Probably our most famous project is the Dickens Bay Wind Farm. I'm sure everybody's heard about that project. South Africa's got an immense opportunity of renewable energy. We've got vast energy resources. We've got the space. We've got the skills. We've got the grit. And this has been proven through the REAP process. So Eskom has already connected 1,600 megawatts of renewable plants. And this is through rounds one and two. And I think the country has proven that we can do it. We've got all that we need in the country to roll out the large scale of renewable energy. And it is possible for us to achieve 100% renewable energy target by 2050. We've done this by submitting this project at a lower cost than coal, new coal, lower than Dupi, lower than Kusile, lower than gas, lower than nuclear would be. And the latest growth, in the last round three, we were 25% cheaper on wind, 5% cheaper on solar, than new coal. Yes?
Did you say cheaper than existing baseload coal?
No, new.
Cheaper than Madrid, new, yeah, but not existing.
Yeah, so the keyword is new coal, not existing baseload coal. Okay. Yeah, obviously, I mean, the existing baseload coal has been made 20, 30 years ago, so bad thanks, best money. Round 4 was going to be announced in 24 November. It's going to be cheaper again. So it's a very competitive market, and we hope to see that the prices will drop even further. So that's the cost issue addressed as well. I have to mention that South Africa has spent 11 billion rands on heating diesel plants the past financial year, and I mean that's a considerable amount of money money flowing out of the country, of course, we need to buy diesel from offshore. Just to elaborate on opportunities, so we are delivering today on jobs, on construction jobs, and all of these projects have been made all across the country. We can deliver tomorrow on direct and indirect jobs for the manufacturing industry. But what we need, and I'll get to that later, is that we need a long-term vision and a sizable volume of projects or pipeline to realize that. And in the medium term, we can use South Africa as a platform, as a base to sell the project skills and knowledge into the rest of Africa. You have to ask yourself the question, what is Africa going to buy in terms of energy? Are they going to do nuclear? Are they going to do coal? I mean, yes, there's going to be gas, but there's a considerable opportunity for renewable energy as well. And the thing about renewable energy is that it is not rocket science. It is not very advanced, high-tech equipment that one needs. It is equipment that the world understands by now, and it's equipment that we can manufacture locally using the existing skills and resources that we've got. So basically, to enable that, we propose a 2,000 megawatts procurement of wind and solar energy every year for a period of 20 years. So we've got this long-term vision of volume and commitment from government to stimulate this industry. The RE process, which has been very successful by Department of Energy, and it's world-renowned, goes up to round 5, so that is next year. What happens beyond that? The industry is not certain yet. So it's very difficult for people to invest in manufacturing and creating down the value stream jobs and opportunities without knowing where the industry and where the sector is going. And I mean, I think that's one of the big issues at the moment. In terms of the RE process as well, I just spoke about the pricing. The pricing was very, very competitive, but the industry feels that we are racing to the bottom, and we're ending up with projects of pricing that is non-sustainable. And the fact that we've already been able to be more cost-effective than new coal, why don't we put a floor price on renewables, and we then ask and increase our targets in terms of value for money for the country? So we increase local content requirements, we increase socio-economic and enterprise development requirements, and we push that up. So it means that because all of these things ultimately has an impact on the tariff of price. So let's put a floor price in, and developers stop competing just on price, they start competing on all the other aspects which is going to add value to the economy and that adds value to our country as well. Just in terms of the resource of our country, yes, we all know about the solar, we know it's in the northern part of the country, the northwestern part of the country, but even on our coastlines and on our big cities and everything, we still have a solar resource that is far better than any place in Europe, except for Spain perhaps. The bottom left picture is our wind map. Now, you will see the green and the blue parts there, and it's not all next to the coast. There's a considerable amount of wind energy potential up in Northern Cape, Southern Free State, and even up to the Northwest Province as well. So if you build a wind farm in the blue and green areas, you will have a financially viable, very competitive wind farm. And we all know those areas have got enough space, got enough land. Look, we obviously always need to be responsible in terms of where we put this infrastructure in terms of environmental concerns and all of that. That's an odd, okay, let's say. Okay, so in terms of manufacturing jobs, sorry, I just jumped a slide here, but it's not a problem. Okay, in terms of jobs, so we need a long-term certainty in volume. I just want to re-emphasize, there's already a lot of jobs happening in the sector through the construction and through some manufacturing happening locally. There's already a target implemented by the repros that a minimum threshold target of 40% local content for wind, 45% for solar. So there's already a lot of that happening. But there was a reluctance from international road players committing to the market because it was a short period. Round 4 has been bidded, hopefully announced by end of November. Round 5 is next year, and beyond that, nobody knows yet how the process is going to work. If you look at the RFP, makes provision that we will procure further renewable energy. At this moment in time, it's not clear how and when you're going to do it. So in terms of our job created, if you look at our international markets, I mean, we're looking at
potentially non-jobs for megawatt installed in Germany and Denmark. And that is basically the due to the vertical integration as well, manufacturing components as well. If South Africa embarks on this for a 20-year, 2 gigawatt a year process, I mean, you look at 360 direct jobs, not indirect jobs, not jobs with regards to having energy available and all the other centers of the industry, direct jobs in the specific industry. And if you look at the REAP commitments made in terms of job education around 1, 2, and 3, if you look at our own commitments made, these figures that you see up there is representative of that. If you look at, I mean, what can we manufacture locally, specifically wind, as blades, towers, gearboxes, all these kind of things. All these things is basically existing industry that can be leveraged to make this. We don't need to set up new industry. Yeah, well, if you look at a tower is a large steel structure. We've got existing industry that can have large steel structure. It is not something new. It's an extension of what we already have in terms of steel. Blades, it's glass fiber. So, I mean, we've got industries providing that services. We've got the skills in the country. We can train more and we can expand on that. Blades are very, very labor-intensive. Instead of making it elsewhere in the world, shipping basically hollow glass fiber filled with air all the way down to South Africa, these things can be made locally. And really, you can't make it with machines. It needs to be done by hand, ultimately. Solar is the same thing. Panels, tables, all that, it's very labor-intensive. Work, especially tables and then civil works on site and packing all these panels. I mean, at the Arden Bloemfontein solar plants, we stacked 276,000 panels. So each of those panels has to be picked up by someone and put down, bolted fast, plugged in the back, and it's a repetitive job that creates a lot of jobs during the construction period as well. And obviously there's whole supporting, the financial part of it, the logistics part of it, the environmental process of it. I mean, I've been working in this industry for the past 6 years now, and it's amazing how much energy and time has been spent with specialists and resources and measurement equipment to gear up the industry to make it ready to roll out in the review process. And that's all job and value being created across the country. Just to further on that, if I take Jeffers Bay wind farm as an example, 140 megawatt wind farm, we can do these things quickly. 18 months from start of construction till producing energy into the grid. No delays, not over budget, and we did all safely. We spent more than 1 million man-hours of labor on the site, not one lost time incident. And that is remarkable. The industry, wind and solar, has got a significant pipeline of projects across the whole country. And so we can deliver on this vision. It is not pie in the sky. It's not something for tomorrow. It's not a plan we need to think out. It's day to day. We can do it tomorrow. We know it's cheaper and we can run quickly. Give us the opportunity and the industry will deliver it. We've proven it. I mean, this is local construction jobs on Jeffers Bay. I mean, we've worked in a peak of construction up to 700 people, of which 70% was from the local community. And we're very proud to be able to say that. Local procurement, I mean, I've went with all of that. Another thing about renewable energy is decentralized. You don't need to put it all in one place. You can put it all across the country, and you can have all rural and municipal areas getting the benefit of this. And the other part is it gives you, to some extent, stability as well. So you don't have one large power station. If something goes wrong, that power station is off, and you lose 4 gigawatts from the grid. I mean, you'd rather have 2,000 turbines, which is a power generation entity by itself, scattered across the country. If there's a problem somewhere, you lose a small portion of your power generation capability. Public-private partnerships. If you look at what in our perspective would be the best balance, is that government give us the framework and the policies to be able to operate within and to enable this industry to move forward. Government can procure electricity on behalf of consumers. The one thing that people need to understand about renewables is that they only buy energy when it's there. If the plant doesn't produce, it's not a risk for government or anybody else because they only buy the energy that goes through the meter at the end of the day. Again, government needs clear rules, clear mission, a clear process, a long-term vision, and a sizable pipeline. The private companies, we take the risk. There's a considerable amount of risk being taken in all this development of projects. Mainstream ourselves has not developed a number of projects because of certain issues, environmental, wind, solar, all of the above. And generally one out of three projects actually make it to construction, and that they lose traction along the way for various reasons. And I don't think government should take that risk. It's let the private sector take that risk. And then make the private sector accountable in terms of providing meeting targets in terms of local content, jobs, skills development, all of that. And be very clear and very specific and very harsh on that. So if you don't abide to the rules, don't play. And I think as long as the rules are clear and it's upfront, then everyone knows and everybody can follow that. I just I've touched briefly on municipalities, and the key thing about renewable energy is that it can be distributed, it can be placed in areas close to municipalities. So we're playing with this concept that we supply, or the industry can supply renewable energy directly to municipalities, either within the municipal borders or just on the fringe of municipal borders, and with electrical lines right into the municipal grid. So it means you take Eskom completely out of the equation, and you fix the price for the next 20 years, or a certain portion of your price. So if you install or deliver renewable energy for the municipality, it's about 30% of the municipality's need. 30% of your price for electricity for the municipality is fixed for the next 20 years. You know what your price is going to be. You don't know what your price of coal is going to be in the next 10 years, or what your price of gas is going to be in the next 20 years. You don't know what Eskom tariff is going to be. And I mean, I just noted this earlier, there's a sensitivity to nuclear and the impact on price of nuclear. So renewable energy, you know today what you're going to pay in 10 years' time. The fuel is free. There's no exposure to the fuel cost. You can also tie that in, obviously, with efficiencies. I'm not going to go into more detail because, you know, I'm sure everybody knows about making municipalities energy efficient as possible, and the lowest hanging fruit is public lighting. That's just basically some figures we've done from Nelson Mandela Metro, and you can look, I mean, the savings is close to 20 million rand over 20-year periods, and this is based on real data of measurements of the wind resource in the municipal area, and this is compared to what we know we can deliver wind energy at to the metro, and we've obviously made some certain assumptions in terms of price increases in the future, specifically on behalf of the national utility. The other interesting thing to note is that the wind resource in certain parts of the country actually produce when we need it, in the evening peak, and that's basically the speculative by the top left-hand graph. And that's something to take into consideration as well. So this whole argument about baseload, you need to take it into perspective, is that when do we produce renewable energy, when do we need it, and how all of that gets integrated. Because there's a variability supply for renewables, we all accept that. But we've got a massive country, and Eskom themselves has done a lot of space, and they have got it up to about 30% of all renewables you can bank on as baseload. Energy that will always be in a grid, whether it's from the Eastern Cape, the Western Cape, the Northern Cape. So in terms of renewable energy as well, that's where the world's going. We all know about Germany wanting to shut down the nuclear plants. So this is where the world's going. Everywhere, wind energy has been installed, the technology that's been installed the most in the whole of the world. There's no other technology, not coal, not nuclear, not gas, that's been installed more than wind energy for the past 12 months. And solar is ramping up significantly. As soon as the solar price is dropping on a global scale lower and lower and lower, the take-up for that is going to be immense. And where North Africa is going to be producing that in this whole structure? Are we going to be ready to take on Africa in terms of supplying this equipment? But we need to set up the local industry here. We all know about carbon taxes, we know about the price of carbon. How is South Africa going to sell our products into international markets if there's a price of carbon in 2016, 2017? What's the penalties going to be for that? And it's something that we need to think about very hard, because at the moment we are on back foot. 95% of our electricity comes from coal. So there will be taxes and there will be premiums and we will not be competitive on a global stage. The path forward, again, I said long-term pipeline volume. That's what the industry needs. We propose a full price in the reprocess so that we can leverage other benefits in terms of local content. And the renewable sector can deliver fast, quickly, and we're the cheapest. And it's proven. We've done it. It's not, it's not a concept, it's not an idea. And that's just the case for me. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rianica. It certainly is really very exciting, especially now you mentioned you got the one at Nelson Bay. Is that Nelson Mandela Bay, is that right?
Yeah, so our round one preferred bidder project, which is completed today, is one at Jeffreys Bay. So it's just outside the Nelson Bay municipality and Koga municipality. But it's
to those two, are they feeding into the metro system, or are they being used to power up different plants, and the balance of what's left is used is fed into the metro system? How's it working?
So the projects are connected to the national grid. The energy goes to where need is on the national grid. So it's connected to Eskom's national grid. So it's not feeding directly to the municipalities. What we propose is an initiative to feed directly into municipal grid as well, that can run in concurrence with the Department of Energy's reprocess. Because at the moment the reprocess has got...
Would that require legislative change?
It wouldn't require legislative change as far as I'm concerned. We just need a program or clients, a willing client, political will to do that. The other key requirement, obviously, is we know that municipalities do have financial concerns and issues, so we would need that the process back being backed by the National Treasury, which is the same as for the reprocess as well. It's just, Eskom, at the moment, there's a buffer between reprocess and the consumer, which is Eskom. And we would prefer to provide that, let's take Eskom out of the equation. Eskom has got its own challenges at the moment, and let's deal with municipalities directly. Of course, the reality is that the industry and the sectors that take most for electricity today is the people in municipalities, not people being supplied directly by Eskom. Yes, I'm asked to take a question.
Thank you very much. So now we'll go across to the committee in detail. Honourable Gil Lewis, followed by Honourable Cornell, followed by Honourable Mcconkey.
Okay, let me just quickly respond to that. It's not going to help to do that, because the problem that we need to address is the price that the end user pays. So whether the electricity comes from Eskom via the municipality or comes from you via the municipality is not relevant to the end user, because the municipality is still going to hike the price to make money. The problem in Africa is not where the council gets the power from. The problem is that they hike the price and make the end user pay that inflated price. And that model doesn't do anything to solve that. The councils rely on electricity surcharges for revenue to make their books balance. So, you know, it may make supply simpler if it doesn't have to be cartwheel, whatever they call it. I forget what it's called, around the Eskom grid. But it doesn't make the price any better for the end user. But besides that, I mean, the presentation is very exciting. You know, it's what you guys have done in South Africa in a very short space of time. It's fantastic. I completely support your call for more policy certainty and some clarification of what's going to happen at the end of next year. Because it seems that there's a huge potential for job creation and development in the sector. So I really hope that happens. I just wanted to ask you a very simple question. These great pictures in this book of these wind towers in Durban, is it Durban?
That's correct.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask where those were made, those big towers. In Durban. Yeah, I just wanted to ask where they were made, those big towers. And also the panels that are in the book as well.
I should answer just yet. We're going to get the bank off questions, all right? But just remember, I'm also having a look at that myself. Yes, Arnold Cornhole?
Yeah, Chairperson, thank you very much. You cannot talk about the wind towers and not addressing the environment. And you cannot talk about the wind towers not addressing the impact on the tourism industry. So there must be some sort of research done for how many jobs you created with the wind tower by destroying tourism, because people don't want to go there, because it becomes a very visible pollution and some other reasons. So what I want to ask, have you addressed that? And secondly, I think the Jay Bay project was perfect because you're not scarring anything there. But if you're going to more remote areas of South Africa and you're going to more remote areas in the Transkei, you will just kill tourism off in those areas because people and tourists don't like what they see. Nice to see it. Wonderful if I drive to Caledon and I see it in the little town of Caledon. It's good. It resembles progress. And it's really certainly not killing tourism because they're not relying on tourism. But if you start doing it in the wrong places just because there's wind, I think you need a comparison whether you will not kill off other jobs. So that will be a hot debate in South Africa and you have to address it. Secondly, solar is the way to go. We can solarize Parliament. We can put it on top of the roofs. We can go ballistic with regard to solar on all roofs in Johannesburg, in Cape Town. We don't need to disturb the environment to do that. So a huge emphasis on that, I think it's fantastic. But wind towers, I think it's sensitive. Just to add on Honorable Hugh Lewis, am I correct that in some instances Europe or other providers are dumping the old stuff in South Africa and using, you know, top-of-the-art stuff in Europe, but the sort of second-class wind towers are coming to South Africa because they're cheaper?
Thank you, Honorable Colonel. Honorable Mkongi.
No, thank you very much, President. I'm all excited about the presentation. I have a few questions. One, if you speak about the policy intent, what are those areas? You know, Honorable Lewis asked whether it's supposed to be a legislative intervention on this particular matter. He said, no, not necessarily, but it needs my political will. But at the end of the day, you're also speaking about the question that you want to be certain in terms of policy. One of the areas of policy that I can talk to you about is a 20-year commitment of the state to the matter. So what are these issues? What some of these issues should be decided politically, maybe through regulation or through legislation. So what areas and what do you see as a way forward? The second one is the question of the price or cost. Because if you say in order to enable municipalities to cut down on electricity cost, now that cutting down or the price that you charge the municipality, is it not going to affect negatively the user, our people, you know, where they are supposed to be paying for the use of electricity because they're paying to the municipality? You know, so the cost or charge that's made to the municipality, is it going to help us that our people receive electricity cheaper, or is it going to make them to receive electricity expensive than it is? So that is what is very important to me that I want to, you know, ask the question. The last question is the slide. There was a slide on the PPP there. The problem is that I don't have this presentation. I'm not sure whether we can go back on public partnership.
Please state it because it's been available. You should have it. There were a whole lot of presentations here. Thanks.
Oh, yes. Yeah, this one. The best balance. And then we are putting your offerings there. That this could be the responsibility of the state, this could be the responsibility of the private sector, and this is the responsibility perhaps of communities. What I want is, what are the benefits for South Africa? Other than the question of job creation and other things, what are the benefits? Because where I'm moving the thing is that the potential of South Africa manufacturing all these products that you're talking about. I'm supposed to be importing the skills, and if import those skills,
how much time are we going to take to train our people to give them capacity to produce those things on their own, and how many years for that?
Thank you very much, Honorable Nyenge.
Yeah, Mr. President, let me also sing the next song with regard to the importance and of the presentation. I want also to hammer on the issue that relates to the benefits targeting South Africa, especially the poor. This comes at a time when South Africa has taken a decision to reintroduce manufacturing. To say in this setup, we are not going to take wind from elsewhere. There will be wind where you would want to put this equipment up. But the most problematic area is the supply of that. Will it be possible to manufacture internally in the country all those apparatus and equipment that is going to be used, because it is going to be based on our land, in order that for the maintenance and surveillance of the program, and also for the program to be self-sustainable without interference of the outside world, then how do you then anticipate the method of ensuring that the problems that exist in solar provision is actually not encountered in your offer? Because right now there are solar systems that have been put on the houses of the poorest people, but 3 months down the line that does not work, and the municipality is not involved in that, and no one is actually taking responsibility to maintain. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now we'd ask either one of you to respond, Mr. Rehaka. State your name as you respond, thank you.
Mangalisa Morgan, finance manager for Mainstream, responded to the transformer, to the turbine question. The turbines were not made in South Africa because of the program requiring that the turbines be certified. So the entire turbine must be certified from top to bottom. We don't have a South African turbine that is certified in terms of an international standard. So that's the first point. Though the turbines were not made in South Africa, the transformer, which is a significant portion of the installation of the turbine, is made in South Africa, and the transformer was locally produced. I'm not exactly sure who the producers were, but about 11% of the turbine value was produced in South Africa, at least. Also, a turbine is a very important part of the wind farm, but the greater support is also important. The wiring that goes from the turbines to the substation, the roads that allow you to maintain the turbine, the base of the turbine is also all concrete and it's all South African. And the contract went to Mary Roberts, who did all that work, which is all local South African work, and which is the most labor intensive work. The turbine is not labor intensive as a BOE in terms of a construction point of view. And the portion that we could do at the time, we did do locally. As we go forward, the towers are made in South Africa, yeah? Towers, so round three, the towers will be made in South Africa. So as we go forward, we can advance the amount of local content, and the Department of Energy has requested higher levels of local content. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rehaka.
Thanks, Bangi. Just to add to that, the GFSA project was a round one project. It was the first large utility scale wind project in sub-Saharan Africa. Group with obviously the other round one projects as well. So yes, some of the wind turbines were important. A large portion of that were imported Going forward, round three, the towers are all made locally. It's two tower plants, one in Atlantis, one in Nkuhu Island, that's producing towers supplying the industry. The thing is that it's a process. You're not going to start day one and manufacture everything locally. That's what we ask, is we want a long-term commitment, so that, and then government take control and push up the numbers, make the local content requirements higher, so that people need to manufacture locally to participate in the program. But the only way you're going to get people to set up a plant to manufacture locally is by giving them a long-term volume pipeline. I think everybody would agree with that. In terms of just on the municipal question, yes, I do agree that the problem lies with the municipal market from buying from Eskom and supplying to end user. And yes, that is a big source of revenue for municipalities. But if you install 30% or 10% or whatever the number is of renewable energy supplied to the municipality today, the municipality will save immense amounts of money over 20 years, which the municipality must then decide what do they do with that money. Do they pass it on to the consumers, or do they incentivize people to invest in the municipality? That's a question for the municipality, and that's supposedly something that the renewable energy won't be able to address. All we're saying is there is this opportunity to be able to do that. And if municipalities are willing to say, look, we see a long-term saving here, and we would like to pass that on to our consumers or and poorest of the poor and everyone inside the municipalities. But unfortunately, we won't be able to address that.
I want to...
Okay, so I'm happy to go on with the rest of the questions, or... Okay.
No, I'm interested in, this is what I'm interested in. Do you mean, if you install, let's say, a wind or you use a solar, you mean that price or cost is going to be costed, nothing changes, that will influence increases or decreases in terms of what the municipality is going to pay, which can influence that municipalities can reduce what our people are paying for electricity, for energy, by what? Not only, by the way, the consumers. Consumers, to me, will also mean industry that is suffering in the municipalities because of outages. You know, by what?
Look, we won't interrupt again. We'll wait till you've concluded. Right.
Thank you. Yes, I want to confirm that if you sign a procurement deal for renewable energy today, you know what your cost is going to be in 20 years' time, because the fuel is for free. There's no market instability on the cost of your fuel. Yes, there will be increases in which can be negotiated up front. So is it CPI minus 2 or 3%? Is it only the CPI portion on your operations maintenance? That's all agreed up front, and that's the way we don't do the reprocess now. So this is not a new concept or something. This is the way to do the reprocess now. So the reprocess price of energy is fixed for the next 20 years. The government knows what they will pay in year 17, 18, 19, 20 exactly. So you take away all the risk, everything else. Okay. Second question is from Honourable Member Kuernhoff. Yes, I agree 100% with you. We need to be responsible in terms of the environment. And I would like to put your ease that through the development of these projects, there's a whole environmental process that also takes part, which addresses tourism, which looks at birds, which looks at bats, which looks at all of these different factors. So tourism and all of that is definitely considered during the development of these projects. There is always any new development, whether it's a road, a power line, a wind farm, or anything else, do have people opposing it. And I think it's a question of managing it and being responsible. What I'd also like to add here is that the Department of Environmental Affairs has embarked on a strategic environment assessment every for wind and solar farms, and they kind of do a pre-scan as well of certain areas and addressing all of these concerns that you've listed. What I also want to note is that people have got this perception that the whole Northern Cape and the whole Karoo is going to be scattered with turbines, which is not going to be the case, because wind turbines and solar farms need to be close to the grid. So yes, there's going to be certain areas in the country where there's going to be lots of wind and solar farm. But it's not going to be that we're going to drive all the way from Pohol to Duristein and use energy rotor turbines all over the place, all the way from Utterworth to Elliot and see the same thing. You need to be close in certain areas where there's grid. And as I've already said, mainstream has stopped developing certain projects with environmental concerns. Of which some of that was due to concerns with heritage as well, and tourism and everything that ties with that. So it's a dynamic public process, and we do definitely address that in the development. In terms of solar energy, solar is the way to go. Yes, I agree, solar is the future. But for me, it's not just one technology. It's all technology. Solar, wind, hydro, biogas, landfill, everything. We need to use everything that's got its role to play. You need to obviously know that solar produces energy through the day. It can't produce through the night unless you use storage. Probably storage will come. It will be there eventually. Not there yet. Wind produces 24 hours. And it runs up and down in its variability. So it's a place for wind, it's a place for solar. And the beauty about solar is that, yes, as you stated, you can put it on the rooftop, you can put it next to the places where you need it, in Gauteng and all of these places. So it's all a symphony of all of these technologies playing together. And we definitely advocating both technologies, wind and solar, because they each got a separate role to play. In terms of your question about dumping old stuff and equipment, that is not the case. And I think we will not be able to achieve these low prices in the reprocess with people dumping old second-rate technology on the market. And the other thing we need to take in mind is that all these projects are debt. Now, we borrow money from international institutions to install the projects. We're talking about, they mean funds go to rebuilding lands. So 75% of that money was borrowed. So no bank's going to borrow your money for second-class equipment that's not going to make it. So I think that does not happen. There may be cheaper, smaller-scale solar panels being imported and sold into the commercial or residential market, but these kinds of large projects with treasure banking and funding from international repos, I don't see that happening. And again, if people do choose to use second-rate technology, they take the risk. If the wind farm falls over and doesn't produce energy, it's no risk to the consumer, because the consumer, the taxpayer, only pays for energy which is produced. So ultimately, it's the developer's risk, or the wind farm owner, or the solar farm owner's risk. It's your risk what equipment you want to use. In terms of the legislative intervention and such needs, Look at the process. It works. There it operates. It was political, structural setup. We've operated in that environment, and it's been very successful and delivered. The one key thing that I would potentially want to table and ask for is fair access to the national grid, the East Mobile. I think that's very important for the industry going forward. It's able to control timelines and costs of connecting to the national grid. At the moment, it is quite difficult to, first off, understand what is the requirements of connecting to the grid, because all the information is made available to us to understand our impact of connecting to the grid. And the second thing is the costing and the timing of connection to the grid. So I think that's key for us. So and we don't want to access the grid for free. The grid belongs to the country, and we need to pay a fair way to that. All we ask for is a fair cost for it, which is reflective, and clear rules in terms of entering into the grid. In terms of the benefits for private-public partnership, I mean, talk about the jobs, talk about industrialization. If there's a long-term pipeline with volume, it will come. Government must set up the rules and force the private sector to play according to those rules. And if you don't play according to those rules, then you're out. It's very clear. It's also all the secondary things. I mean, which we spoke about carbon taxes, talk about exporting our products into the rest of the world. We also need to think about, I mean, what's Africa going to do, and where are they going to get the equipment from, and how are we going to export our skills and everything. In terms of skills development, I believe a large proportion of the skills that we need is already there.
it's just a question of leveraging what we've got and expanding on that. I mean, doing a bladed fiberglass work, if you look at all the boat building industry in along the coastline in the Western Cape, I mean, that skills is the exact same skill. Take it here and plug in there with limited training. So I'm not concerned about it. But again, set the targets, set the pipeline, give us the volume, and we'll deliver on that. And for me, it's a no-brainer. In terms of benefiting the poor in the within municipalities, and I think I really answer that, is that it will enable municipalities to ask for cheaper energy in the future. But that depends on the municipality. They would need to make that decision. This program potential idea or vision will just enable the municipality to do that. And obviously, if you're going to have these power plants in or close to municipalities, then it's direct jobs as well. People need to build it, people need to maintain it, people need to operate it, and there's a whole spin of industry as well. In terms of the solar systems, which is poor quality, I assume you referred to the solar water heating issue. Yes, that is a concern in terms of that, and we've all seen the press about it. Particularly cannot comment in directly, it's not my field of expertise. The one thing I want to mention though is that what we're proposing is, again, if we don't reduce energy, we take the risk, we lose. I'm saying the private sector. A solar water heater on a person's roof, yes, that person's office, because that person is not getting hot water. So we just make a good distinction between the two. I think in terms of the funding and everything and second rate set equipment, I've addressed some of that concerns as well. I think I've addressed all of it. I'm happy to answer more if needed.
Yeah, I'd just like to add on some of the benefits. One of the main benefits is indigenization of energy, which is within the slide. Once you make power your power generation your own, so what we've done is make power generation in the Northern Cape, in the Western Cape, in the Eastern Cape. So power doesn't have to come all the way up from Malahleni down. So it's indigenized power locally. For instance, in Europe, they're held ransom by Russia, who can just turn off the gas plant at any point. So the more you indigenize power, the better it is for your country. Whether as a country, as a region, as an area, as a municipality, it's a good thing. You put the power back in your hands. Other honourable speakers, question on how long will it take to do this thing? As Panda said, these tools already exist. While the plant at the dock about 2 years ago, which we visited, and they were building turbines, and they were just waiting for certification until they just couldn't afford to run the plant any longer. The certification took too long to get. But the skill is there. There are standard type turbines in the world that everybody can manufacture. It's the Model T4 of turbines. You know, there are very standard specs for these things. And as Handel said, it's not rocket science. It's not nuclear physics. It's mechanics.
Thank you very much. Now you may have addressed this, also had one or two other issues to pursue at the same time. But another question was raised with respect to these towers. Where had they been manufactured locally or imported? But if they were imported, where were they imported from? And why can't we manufacture it? The Jeffreys Bay, that wind farm.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to note again is that the towers for the Jeffreys Bay wind farm was imported from overseas, and I believe it came from Denmark, as far as I recall. We can manufacture these towers locally, and I'm delighted to tell you that for round three, the towers are manufactured locally, because it's big steel structures. So the round three renewable energy program, which is closing hopefully by end of November, the towers for those wind farms will be manufactured in South Africa. There are going to be two plants set up already. The one plant is in the Kuga IDZ. The other plant is actually in Atlantis here in the Western Cape. Atlantis? Okay, so in the Western Cape. And again, this is government that forces, because government increased the local content requirement. So government said, if you want to participate in the process, you need to provide 40% of your capital expenditure must be local manufacturer goods. And then the only way to achieve that was by either building towers or blades locally. And the industry has responded, and they set up at-risk two tower masks to provide these towers to the economy. And what we're saying is that we will see more of that, give us long-term pipeline, give us volume.
Just one thing, because you seem to have easier access to some of this information. Well, you mentioned it already, Atlantis and Kucha, where we now are producing these towers, all right? How many workers are employed in the production? We're very pleased to hear about the localization. Very pleased indeed. But the other thing you referred to was something, turbines at one point. And I think you've got turbines here, and I believe we can produce those turbines. If we aren't producing them, why not?
In terms of the job numbers for these two tower plants, I don't have it at hand. I'm happy to research and send the numbers to you. I know these two projects or entities was done. The one is DCD Durable, which is a local company. The other one is Kasambuint, which is a Spanish company, but they went through local partnerships and local joint ventures in terms of job creation and everything. In terms of the wind turbines, and all of it being manufactured locally. So maybe the one question is that the Department of Energy has run a very vigorous process where they actually require that all the plants being installed, wind and solar, is certified according to the IEC, international standards, everything. So all of that takes quite a bit of time to get certified. So that's why round one, localization was not that hard, because industry was ready to respond. For round three and part of round two, it could happen if people did respond to it. So that's the tower. There was one turbine manufactured locally here in Cape Harbour by IWIC. The problem was that turbine is not in its entirety certified. So nobody in the REIT process was able to use that turbine or procure the turbine. Banks and lenders weren't able to back it as well because, I mean, it wasn't a proven turbine. But we will get there. There's no reason that we will not be able to get it. As long as the target by government is set high enough in order to achieve that, and we enable these people to come and install manufacturing capability by giving them a long-term vision.
Thank you very much. What I think we're going to ask is whatever further information you have in respect of what we have requested, if you'd let us have it in writing. I don't know if Wednesday would be all right for you. And I'm also looking at Mr. Munger because, you know, DTI would be aware of some of these projects, I know, if it's possible for you to try and elicit the information around the workers and the popular. Whatever it is you can get, we'd appreciate it. Because the message we want is the localization is increasing. We are beginning to manufacture it here, and consequently, X number of workers, you know, jobs have been created, and also that is what you call, you know, productive foreign direct investment, where it's coming in, the development of plants, and joint venture. That's exactly where we're going. And there isn't any, you know, grouping politically that is opposed to us trying to grow jobs in this manner. I mean, it's a very good idea indeed. The only thing here, you know, it's a glass. I wanted to ask the question, the glass on the solar panels, I believe that South Africa, notwithstanding the fact that we are able to produce glass, can't produce the glass for the tubes used in that solar panel. Is this in fact the case, seeing as you're also involved in this kind of work and technology? And would it be that, take that long for us to develop such a plant, especially if we were to go the route of the solar panels, etc.? Thank you.
I'm not 100% familiar with the issue of the glass, but if I look at I visited the plant in a research plant in Stellenbosch, which basically look at thin film plants basically producing. And yes, there was a question about the quality of glass used on these thin film panels. And again, it's a question of the local glass industry is designed to operate within a certain environment and framework and provide a certain quality because that's what the market wants. Okay? So that's all the plants to operate glass for a certain function and role. Okay? So now I say there's a new function and a new role, and this factory is looking at it, what is my market for that? How much is that going to be? And unfortunately at this moment, because there's not a long-term vision, there's not a long-term commitment as well. So difficult, but I'm convinced that anything we need and any technology we need, if the vision is there and the pipeline and the volume is there, people will just invest. I mean, it makes a lot of sense to me.
Essentially what you're saying is what business would require from government, from the public sector, is some commitment that this is a route we're going to test seriously with respect to energy. We want to have the solar panel, solar energy, and therefore we would require these glass tubes. Some sort of long-term commitment in that respect, and after which you would expect, or we can expect, business to look at that and then invest in the establishment of a plant. That's how I'm understanding you.
I just want to add to that there is a cost to localization because we need to compete with global players like China and India. But what I'm saying is that we are already cheaper than you call. So how much cheaper do we want to be? So put a floor price on it. The average price for around 3 wind is 74 cents, which is 25% cheaper than we expect or do we consider to be. So make the floor price 85 cents and then use that 10 cents to pay for the more expensive equipment in South Africa.
All right, like I said, try and give us as much information as you can. Do you want to add anything, sir?
I'd like to add that recently there was a solar panel manufacturing hub opened up in the West Cape. I don't remember the Hadendela Rock Day, with all of the openings. It was called Rooftop Solar with a Chinese partner. They will be generating 120 megawatts each year and employing 250 people. So little, so there.
Thank you very much. And when we say there's a cost to localization, there's a cost to unemployment as well. So we have to balance these challenges as any government would. But we do appreciate you. Yes, Honourable Mpongi?
No, I'm actually excited that this presentation is made by two capable South African young people. You know, and then for me, as a youth activist, it tells us that we are taking South Africa forward, and that this is the youth that we need to concentrate with the services, but we need to transfer services to the majority of young people. Thank you very much, sir.
I think it is very exciting, and the main concern that we have here with adding value, because of industrialization, the jobs issue, etc., but also the reduction in cost to imports. If we can produce it, it cuts that as well. So there are a number of factors we would want to look at, and we will take this on board and factor it in. It offers us, here's yet another alternative. And it's quite constructive that you have already established these plots. And so we've got something to look at. And what are the challenges that they posed, and what are the successes, and so on and so forth. But thank you for your time. We do appreciate it, both of you, really do. And from committee itself, I want to just point out one or two. We seem to have permanent programming issues. Part of that is also because Parliament also has changes in its programs. I'm looking at this, which is dated the 23rd of October. Has it been distributed, Mr. Herman? So if you look at this, you'll see there the briefing on the National Credit Act regulations next week on Tuesday. All right? Now that is the regulations which went out, if you recall, for public comments and so on and so forth. So yeah, they are important, and we ask for them to come back. if we're unable to complete our engagement, it's difficult to say this sort of thing without first seeing them and studying them as to how much time you need. But we thought that we would give this 2 hours. Now, that being the case, we've got the status report by ETI on the committee's recommendations with respect to gambling review, commission reports, etc., etc. And this is on Tuesday. Now, and the horse racing industry. Now, we do know that some of the issues related to the horse racing industry have been withdrawn by one of the, Kemmer. And it may be advisable for us to look at that again. I'm just raising that. Then there's the whole issue around our recommendations with respect to Gambling Review Commission's report. But that report is an older report. It's not the recent one. So at the time when we put these down, we had rather hoped that we have greater progress in some of these areas. But we still have other challenges we need to clarify on the horse racing. I'm not taking the decision yet. I also want to hear from you. Then we've got the consideration, this is the important thing, of the draft colloquium report. Now, our issue here is this. I have repeatedly pointed out since the first term, when we came in as a committee, that we had embarked on this process of value addition and challenges to manufacturing IPAP in the previous term. And we produced a report, a very solid report. And to that end, there was a reference to energy, there was a reference to port prices, transport, a number of what we call administered prices issues. And that then led us to have this colloquium. The challenge we have, as I said to you then, this report was published. It was on the ATC. It was on the ATC. The admin. The challenge we have is that we're now in a fifth term and it was not debated. Well, we may not have, we're not going to debate it per se. But there is a need for the new committee who has had this report because we've issued it 3 times now, that particular report, to refresh their minds on it. And for this to go back again, requested from the table onto the ATC and for us to adopt it as a report we will utilize as part of broader colloquium. It was in fact adopted by the previous committee. I think Honourable Bill Lewis, you were a member of that. It was adopted. We just, due to the programs in the House, it never went into the House itself. So these are the technicalities. So this is the proposal. Report is issued electronically. You have got it, so you can look among your documents. We'll issue it again. We'll get it again on Monday in your cubby holes. We need to just adopt it as our report for the first Parliament. It goes back exactly the same as the ATC. And we then able to link the two, which is this particular one, to that one. And as I say, it was unanimously adopted, that particular report on the colloquium, which was a very solid one. So I would like to add that. So I'm not talking about the beneficiation one, but that larger one into Tuesday, that one. Now, I need your comment here, and I need your agreement. Gambling Review Commission's report. Can you speak to that, Mr. Hermans, just to refresh people's memory?
There was a report published by DTI. The Gambling Review Commission report was published, and the committee had, in the fourth term, had public hearings on the matter, and had a report adopted by the committee. One of the recommendations of that report was that DTI would come back to the committee on the recommendations the committee had made on the matter.
We were never able to do that in the first parliament. It was nearly signed on the program. The first parliament ends on Tuesday. DTI will brief the committee on its view on the recommendations made by the committee in that regard.
Essentially, it is a status report that will prepare us for the new things happening in gambling. There are three new things. One of them is the, you've seen it in the papers, I'm sure, what are they calling it? The EBTs, the bingo issue. Now that came up in that report. Not dealt with, now we're having challenges again, because at that time, the department also acknowledged that there was a need for policy on norms and standards to be revised, developed and passed. We haven't got that. So it's an opportunity, the DDG, and I'm also looking at this NIDU, to brief us. Where are we here? For all I know, we'll get new gambling pieces of legislation thrown in, and half of us don't even know what is the current status as the fifth parliament. Do you follow? So that's a short, it's not a huge issue. Where are we here? What happened here? Etc. And horse racing was another huge issue. And of everything we did in that area, we said that the most untransformed aspect of gambling was the horse racing. They agreed. They also asked Parliament, the government, they need help. They would like to have an association. But there are little associations all over. It's a very fragmented industry. So that could take us on that report another half an hour. So we have 2.5 to, you know, we need at least an hour for consideration of the colloquium report. So my request to you is that we get this briefing on the National Credit Act regulations. We go straight into a status report by the DDG, or we do the consideration of the vast colloquium, and that may be better because we've got a deadline on that. And the reason it's got a deadline, we need to be able to have it on the ATC, the new one. It must be on the ATC by the 4th of November that afternoon. So in other words, it must be processed by then to go in on Wednesday. And my request to you is that we do ask for a debate. Is that, do we have an agreement on that? On the colloquium, yeah. Are we agreed? Agreed. Right, thank you. Then we move to 6th. Then the minister is coming. We don't want too many issues then, because those are all very serious issues. Let's give him that space. And if there's anything else you'd like to raise so that the minister is aware, please let us have it. Yes, Honourable Neil Lewis? It's wrong. The time. We're meeting Thursday night. Let me let Mr. Herman speak. I have a problem here because it depends on too many things. It depends if caucuses end on time. It depends if this happens. The challenge in this week, this is why we've got a problem, is because the House we expected to finish at 6. At 6. It's not finishing at 6 or 5. The House is going on and on. You see what I'm saying? So what we wanted to do is no longer possible. But I don't want to postpone the minister's engagement. I hope that's clear. I want us to try and keep to that. So let me take yourself, Honourable Nkongi, followed by Hill Lewis.
Thank you, Sir President. I just wanted to make concrete proposals. But it's going to depend on the administration that we have. That we agree in principle that on Thursday we are meeting with the minister. Because, for example, the program can change. And then we postpone this issue and then we say it's not happening. It's going to be a crisis. So what is very important is that we agree in principle, but if there are pressing matters, therefore committee members should be communicated to on the change or possible change.
Right. I think we will just leave it like that, follow Parliament's program and see what happens. I think that's best, but I do want a commitment that we will engage with the minister on the 6th. Right, Honourable Hill Lewis.
We have made clear to the committee members that some Fridays will be long days. So we could make Friday the 7th 4 p.m. meeting or something like that. I don't know if the minister would be available, but it makes no difference for us two because we're both Western Capers, but I mean the other members might be a bit annoyed with us.
Well, the 7th is not the day he's going overseas a great deal. We just insisted that we've got to engage with him. This is the day we've got. He's not going to be here on the Friday. So I'm going to close this off by saying we may find ourselves meeting at 8 o'clock till 10 or 12:30 till 2. All right? And that will be communicated. All right? Fine. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Or 8 o'clock till 10.
Yeah, 8 to 10, all that. The last thing is the SAT, etc. I'm finalising this. There are no further changes from the 19th to the 26th. So, yes, we are having a debate on this matter. Thank you.
You mean 8 a.m. to 10 a.m.
Well, we did say 1 hour should suffice. So 1.5 hours. Right. Members, I want to thank all of you. I want to thank Mr. Samunga for being down here again with us. I want to thank yourself, Honourable Professor Tory. And I know it's a lot of work. If necessary on the Friday, we may be able to have to throw off weapons of mass destruction. But I'm saying this for your benefit, Mr. Samunga, and Ms. Nadu, that we're going to be meeting people from this area of space industry. We want to do the whole space issue. Industry weapons the lot. We want them all in here, and I also want the science and technology to be invited on that. Thank you very much. The meeting's adjourned.